Mayfield biographer and son, Todd Mayfield. Comedian and star of Adam Ruins Everything, Adam Conover. And singer-songwriter, Rachel Yamagata. And now here's your host, a man who always blames his microphone, Justin Kaufman.
Whenever a segment goes bad, this is Mike. I can't, you know, I knew it. You're trying to sabotage the show. Welcome to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got a great show lined up for you tonight. We really pushed a lot into tonight. Last night we did all debates. We started at 7 o'clock and we went to 11 on debates. It was a lot of debates. That's one of the good things when the debate is actually, you know, 24 hours ago. You've got enough analysis, enough, you know, armchair quarterback, enough second day analysis, right? I feel like that's where we're at. It's really hard to, we thought about it today. We're like, you know, maybe we should just do another 4 hours. Just open up the phones. What'd you think? We've decided to move on. Tonight, we're going to pick up with Doug Plank tonight. Talk to him about the Chicago Bears' miserable outing on Sunday night. Talk about trying to forget and not continue to talk about it. But bad news for Bears fans today. Jeremy Langford out 4 to 6 weeks with a high ankle sprain. The starting running back, the heir apparent to Matt Forte, out for 6 weeks. You know, you think about all the problems that, and I don't even know, there were no problems with Matt Forte. But the idea that, you know, he's gone and here come the injuries to the running back. Kadeem Carey's out as well. You know, it makes you think again about the idea of giving up so fast on some of the high-priced, you know, Bears of the past. Whether or not going with the unproven is actually worth it. But I guess no matter because we're in it. So we'll talk to Doug Plank about what needs to be done to fix this Chicago Bears team. We don't need to just continue to dwell on the negative. We'll talk about the positive, what the Bears have to do to get on the board when they win against the Lions on Sunday. Doug will be here tonight since we didn't have him last night. Also tonight, Todd Mayfield's going to join us. Todd, the son of legendary musician Curtis Mayfield, a longtime Chicagoan. He's got a street named after him here in Chicago. Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee. An amazing musician that is just, if not alone for his canon of music, for all the songs and all the music that he has produced over the years, not just, you know, saying on that was the name Curtis Mayfield or even the Impressions. I mean, he wrote a ton of music as well. But you hear a lot of these songs, and you hear a lot of the songs today. And a lot of the beats that were produced, the music that was produced by Curtis Mayfield just shows up in a ton of hip-hop music, a ton of R&B, where people are just sampling the work of Curtis Mayfield. So we'll talk with his son, Todd Mayfield, who's written the definitive biography, the Life of Curtis Mayfield, Traveling Soul, that he'll be my guest at the big table. Lots to talk about. I really was today. It was just a really emotional experience reading this book. I mean, I started the morning, you know, reading it. I was at the Panera, you know, already out of souffles, got up too late, said to go with a bagel. And I was reading, I was like, I read all about the Impressions, and then I just kept going all day. I was just like picking at it and picking at it. And I swear, I just, like, within 25 minutes ago, like, finished, got the last word. And I was like, I put it down like it was a summer novel. I was like, what a tremendous, tremendous story. Curtis Mayfield. We'll talk to Todd about that coming up at the big table. I'm excited. Also tonight, Rachel Yamagata. Great Chicago musician, singer-songwriter who now lives in New York State, Woodstock to be exact, just put out a new album, Tightrope Walker. She's going to be at Thalia Hall coming up here soon. She is going to join us to talk about her new music, but also her Chicago roots. She was in the band Bumpus here in Chicago for a long time. So we'll talk to her about what she learned about music from performing with that great band and some of the clubs here in Chi-Town. And then also tonight, Adam Conover is going to join us. He's got a show on True TV. Everyone, Adam Ruins Everything. It's a great show. It's just finishing up season two. He's going to be at the Park West doing the show live on stage, a political show, an election show. So we'll talk to him about that. And the Defiant Thomas brothers, who were guests of mine on the big table, are back tonight. to play the worst. So we got a lot to do tonight, so why don't we get to it? News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, it's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Let's kick things off with the carryout. This, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news. So you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. 100 million people were supposed to tune in last night for the first presidential debate, but only 81 million watched across networks. My guess, they probably got sick of the defective mics. Turns out Donald Trump didn't have a cold. It was just a bad mic. Or as Howard Dean tweeted out, cocaine. Trump went on to say it was probably a bad mic on purpose since the debates are biased. Has Trump ever watched any sporting event ever? When a team loses, you don't blame the sneakers or the basketball or the entire construct of the sport. No, you say we got to get better. And then you just wear cool thrift store fake glasses or a hat that you sponsor. I don't know. It's simple. Get it together. Donald Trump really wanted to talk about Bill Clinton so bad last night. He wanted to throw it in Hillary's face about infidelity, but he took the high road by telling us that he was taking the high road during the debate, during the spin room, and then on the campaign trail today, which I guess is just Fox and Friends. What is that saying about living in glass houses and the tea kettle with the pots and the stones? And no, anybody? What happens now? Well, my guess, both candidates will be respectful and keep a low profile to the next debate, right? Right. In other news, billionaire Elon Musk has his sights set on something bigger than politics. He wants to go to space. And today he announced that he's got a plan to get people to Mars in the next decade. Yep, for $200,000 a ticket, you can go to Mars and help set up colonies. No joke. Unless it's a joke. You can never tell with the internet. This is in stark contrast to NASA that put out a much more conservative timetable that essentially said, no, this is not going to happen. So just saying, if Trump doesn't win the election, I mean, there's probably a need for a mayor on Mars or at least a township supervisor, something. Mars is going to be so huge. Senators want more information from Yahoo over the huge data breach that affected over 500 million users. Like, for instance, they're asking about why in 2016 we're hearing about this hack that reportedly happened in 2014, right? Almost 2 years ago. Why are they telling us now? To their defense, they wanted to tell us, but they use Yahoo Mail and it just took a while to get to the senders, you know, bounce back, delays. Ah, delays. Yahoo. Scientists say that a baby was born with DNA from three different people. Wait, wasn't this a plot to Three Men and a Baby? A man, a woman, and an egg donor. Wow, technology. Back in my day, if this happened, it was usually not something I would put out a press release about, I'll tell you that much. Speaking of love childs, in weather, it's like summer and fall fell in love. And today is said love child. So nice. In sports, the Cubs won their 100th game last night, blowing the Pirates out in Pittsburgh. It's the first time the Cubs have won 100 games since 1935. What an unbelievable season. Also, Kyle Hendricks not only won again, but his ERA is now at 1.99 for the entire season. He has one more start. He's my choice for Cy Young, no doubt. The Cubs' fifth starter at the beginning of the season. Wow. The Cubs really have nothing to play for tonight, and they'll give most of the starters the night off. They'll still win. The Cubs will play the winner of the wild card in the NLDS. Right now, Mets, Giants, and Cardinals within a game of each other. We'll see how that plays out. Maybe they can do the DNA, the man, woman, and the egg donor. I don't know. The Sox won again last night. Chris Sale on the mound tonight. I believe he's slated to pitch the final game of the season on Sunday, but not sure if that's going to happen since Ventura will probably let him pitch 175 pitches tonight. It's amazing that Chris Sale had 14 wins at the All-Star break, and right now he's sitting on 16. At the break, he was 14-3. He's now 16-9. That's 2-6 since the break if you're looking for reasons on why the Sox are so mediocre. Well, that and James Shields. The Bears continue their injury parade with the news that starting running back Jeremy Langford's out 4 to 6 weeks with a high ankle sprain. Wow. So Cutler and Langford on the offense, and McPhee, Trevathan, Lamar Houston, Goldman, and Kyle Fuller on the defense? That's unreal. Is that just bad luck, or does this team not do enough hot yoga? Come on, do some more hot yoga. The power rankings are out, and the Bears are second to last in all of football, and if the Browns kicker wasn't terrible, the Bears would be dead last. The Browns. Come on. You know what?
A lot of home games coming up in October. Plenty of chance to boycott, Bears fans. The Blackhawks kick off the preseason tomorrow night, but they will be without a few key players, including Taves and Hossa, who are still competing in the World Cup of Hockey tournament? What? I thought that was over. That's terrible scheduling. Do that tournament in July. You know, this is ridiculous. Who came up with this idea? Ugh. The Bulls had their first practice today, and Coach Hoiberg said that Rajon Rondo is the best voice of the team. Wait, are they competing for an NBA title, or is P. Diddy bringing back making the band? And finally tonight, the Chuck E. Cheese in Oak Lawn is in hot water with the police. Why? Because of skimming off the top? No. Ripping off families? No. E. coli? No. None of those things. The kids' pizzeria slash arcade is in danger of being shut down because of adult fights. Yep, fist fights keep breaking out. Over what? The last slice of pizza? Who's next in skee ball? Come on, the last place I'd ever want to fight is a Chuck E. Cheese. Cry? Maybe. But not fight. Well, that's the carryout for September 27, 2016. Hey, it's the last week for summer grilling. Next week, all stews. Party thick stews. Deal with it. Coming up, Doug Plank's going to join us to talk about what can be done to fix this Chicago Bears team. Not all is lost. 0-3 can be overcome. But can they beat the Detroit Lions on Sunday? Doug Plank, hopefully we'll have the answers. Coming up here on The Download on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
Oh, man, I'm great. After a bourbon and a couple of extra strength Excedrin, I'm doing just fine, my friend.
That's what it takes.
Wow.
I figured you to be a bear guy.
After last night?
Yeah, right. Oof. It was a long night.
It was.
A long night of analysis.
Good coverage here, though, that's
yeah,
for sure.
No, I had a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
It was fun listening to it. It was fun to hear that listeners had different impressions than people who watched the debate.
Yeah.
If you listened, you had a different understanding or a different sort of takeaway than if you watched. It's interesting.
Yeah. Ill-prepared and missed opportunities, I think, for Trump.
Yeah, there you go.
Got to get his act together.
We'll see what happens on the next debate.
It's a tall order.
Are they going to do the next one's going to be the more – that I like the one where they are at podiums and they walk towards the people, like when they're in the round table or the round – what do you call that? Like a town forum style?
Sure, yeah.
That's my favorite. Yeah. I can't wait till – Donald Trump walks at somebody.
Well, you know Trump's going to have that look on his face. I'm just going to smack you in a stupid question. You know,
a lot of flailing.
We'll
He's
see.
Accidentally hit somebody in the front row.
Sniffling and throat clearing and all kind of stuff going on.
Quite an anthem these days. It's The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, you know, we check in with Doug Plank every Monday here on The Download after a game. Yesterday, of course, because of a special report on the debate, we did not check in with Doug, so we bring him in tonight, which is probably a good thing, too, because it gives us a little bit of time to marinate, to think about what happened, to maybe be able to dim our anger, you know, our frustrations, and say, well, there were a lot of bright, positive things about that game, even though we lost. Doug Plank, isn't that right? I mean, there's a lot of things that after a day or two, you're like, yeah, you know, the Bears played, they might have played better than we thought.
You know, I think with a lot of the running that was taking place in the game ended sooner than we anticipated with fewer spots. That was about the only good news, I think. You know, and not only did they win, I mean, just in watching the game, I think, you know, you started getting a sense early in the game that things were not going well. And, you know, both offense and defense, you know, they were getting outplayed. You know, I really felt like earlier in the game, you know, was actually worse than the second half. You know, when the Cowboys went up to 24-3, I thought, wow, this game is over. And, you know, and there were a few good things, Justin, I think, in the game. You know, there was some physical play early in the game, you know, as far as tackles and hits and things like that. But, you know, just overall, the execution, I thought, was just really lacking. I mean, I thought, you know, that receiver Beasley did a great job for the Cowboys, and Ezekiel Elliott, you know, did a good job running. I think what really, you know, in talking with a lot of the Bear fans since the game, I think their frustration is they look at a team like Dallas, you know, who had struggled also in the last couple of years, But they got two guys now, a quarterback and a running back, that really, you know, secured this win, you know, with key throws throughout the game, you know, and runs and picking up first downs when they needed to with Ezekiel Elliott.
I got to say, I mean, as you think more about, I mean, there was a great moment where Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth, they said, what's the identity of this team? And Chris Collinsworth goes, I don't know. And there seemed to be a lot of confusion about what the Chicago Bears were trying to put on the field this year. After the first three games, we see an 0-3 start. We've seen a lot of mediocrity across the board. Injuries obviously play a big part of that. But for you, Doug, I mean, you've been someone who's run a league, both as an analyst, as a coach, as a former player. You know, we talked in the preseason about identity, what the Bears' identity is around the country. What do you think the Bears' identity is after three games?
Well, you know what? With so much youth on the team, you know, so much change up, you know, from making selections, trades, you know, bringing in free agents. You know, I mentioned to a lot of friends, it's like they're trying to rebuild the rebuild. You know, it's already they're changing up positions with guys that have just been put in position over the last couple of years. So, you know, yes, this is a young team. There's a lot of new players and things like that. But, you know, you start looking at the other team, you know, like passing. You know, I was a defensive back, and, you know, one of the evaluations, okay, how well did we play? Well, you got to start looking at some of the stats. Obviously, everybody looks at the score. But, you know, when you start looking at, like, their quarterback completion, you know, how many passes did he complete?
Yeah, right, right.
He completed almost 80% of his passes.
That's crazy.
And they weren't all short passes. They were downfield. And, you know, when something like that happens, then you got a problem. You know, it's either your pass rush or your coverage is pretty bad.
You know, I was going to ask you this as well. I mean, you were a playmaker, and there have been other plays, whether it be a big hit or a turnover, and we saw this a lot with the Bears of the last generation with Brian Urlacher and company, where the chips may be where the other team comes out and punches you in the mouth, but there are players that possess that ability to make a play on the ball to change momentum. And that is something that we haven't seen with the Chicago Bears team on either side of the ball. Maybe Alshon Jeffery is the one who's got that talent on the offense. But on the defensive side, last year was kind of miserable when it came to takeaways. This year it starting out the same. Who on this team is the guy who is going to step up and make that play that turns the tide?
Boy, you know what? I got to tell you right now, I mean, I think there's some decent athletes on this team and guys that have played well in college and even on NFL teams. But I don't know. I don't see leadership. Like, in between the plays, watching the huddle, I don't see one guy going crazy, yelling, screaming, you know, trying to direct people. It's just like everybody's kind of going through the motion, running off and on the field. And I'm not trying to make this sound, you know, like it's all the coaching fault or whatever the case might be. But, you know, it's got to start somewhere. The emotion, the energy, you know, I found that in the teams that I play for, the emotion started first before you started seeing plays take place. You know, big hits, tackles, runs, all those sort of things. And I just don't see that. I just see, like, there's this calm acceptance of what's taking place. You know, it doesn't seem to me like watching the sidelines. And I'm not saying the sidelines have to be all a bunch of crazy people. But, you know, there still has to be a sense of concern. And, you know, the only thing that I can compare it to is, you know, other teams that are in a similar situation. You know, watching the Buffalo Bills this weekend totally dismantle the Arizona Cardinals. And you know what? That was like a Super Bowl for the Bills. I mean, they came out.
Yeah, their emotion was high, right?
Special teams.
Right.
And that's what it's going to take. I mean, you got to take it one play at a time. And, you know, certainly the Bears have the capacity to win games. And obviously the game this week against the Lions is going to be very important.
Okay, let me ask, before we get to the preview of the Lions game, let's talk about coaching, because we saw on the defensive side of the ball I'm not a scholar when it comes to defensive schemes and what have you, but a rookie quarterback seemed to know what the Bears were going to do and didn't seem to be fazed by any sort of trickery or schemes that Vic Fangio threw at him. Seemed like a pretty preseason-like vanilla-based defense. And then let's talk about the offense. I mean, Dow Loggins and the offense, even with injuries, obviously with Brian Hoyer, the backup quarterback, getting in, they're not when the game was out of hand, yeah, they were throwing plays whatever they wanted to. But again, they're not doing anything that is, you know, world beating the NFL, as we say, you know. So what is it about is something about the coaching staff and the way that we're running our scheme that is not on par with other NFL teams?
Well, I'll just say this. You know, I think, like I said earlier in the season, I think they were trying to throw long passes with really a suspect offensive line. I don't think the offensive line has really played together very well. They're not passing communication information along. You know, we talked before a couple of weeks ago about guys just running off the edge. You know, if you don't have anybody protecting that edge, your quarterback is going to get hurt. And I think, you know, where the Bears are right now with their offensive line, they need a quarterback that can extend plays. That means run out of the pocket, buy himself some time. You know, you start looking at what the Dallas Cowboys have right now with their quarterback. You know, Dak Prescott is a rookie. I mean, he's a young guy. I don't think he's necessarily that adept at reading all the defenses and coverages and blitzes, but he's got, you know, he has got the capacity to run and stay on his feet, right, and extend plays. And that makes such a huge difference, Justin, because even if you don't even know what you're doing or what you're throwing into, everything breaks down after 5 or 6 seconds down the field. So if you can run around for 5 or 6 seconds, I promise you somebody is running wide open. All you have to do is find them. And Prescott seemed to do that over and over and over again.
It's funny. That's
really with the, that's where I think they were successful.
Yeah,
early on.
And you know, to take it from the Bears page, I mean, that's what we thought we were getting with Jay Cutler. I mean, he makes plays with his feet. He continues to play by rolling out and avoiding pressure, but it was on the first couple weeks that was not the case. He was getting drilled. All right, let's talk about the Detroit Lions. I mean, 0-3 start is pretty dismal, and it doesn't bode well for the Bears being competitive, never mind the playoffs, but competitive. But a win at home against a divisional rival, the first NFC North game of the season, that has to be the right place to start.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, especially like we talked before, you know, with only winning, what, one home game last year, you know, and not having won any home games this year. I mean, it's critical. And the fans that I talk to, obviously, they're Chicago Bear fans and have been for a long time. And they've really suffered because this not only goes back to last year, it goes back to the year before that, where I think they only won two games.
Yeah, Trussman, the 2 years of Trussman, that they didn't go, right.
It's you know, really, really frustrating. So, you know, here you are now as a fan, you know, paying a lot of money to go to a home game with parking and, you know, buying a hot dog or whatever down there at Soldier Field. And now all of a sudden, you know, you're in a situation where, you know, you're watching a team that's not very successful and not even winning at home and losing by considerable numbers. And I think that's where the frustration comes into it. And, of course, I know the Bears are trying to do everything they can right now to try to make this thing right. But, you know, right now, with what they've been dealt right now as far as players and situations, I can't see where they can – yeah, in injuries, exactly. I don't know. I hate to say this, but, you know, trying to make a marketable difference in what the results have been over the last few weeks, I think it's going to be very difficult to change.
Doug, you're supposed to come on and say, you know what? I like our chances against Detroit at home.
You know what? I mean, really, I almost prefer to see them play the Lions on the road because I think they're better on the road the most part.
Is that psychological? I mean, is that a mental thing for the Bears at this point? Why can they not win at Soldier
Field? I don't know what it is. Yeah, you know what? You know, a lot of teams do different things. Like, they'll have players go to a hotel the night before. You know, sometimes teams just let their players just stay at home. And, you know, but, you know, if you got a bunch of kids, you know, and it's a noisy night, you know, that's probably not going to be the best situation for getting rest and relaxation and thinking about the game. So most teams do take their players to hotels. I don't know what the Bears do. I just know that, you know, you got to keep changing things up until you find something that works. And I'm sure that they're continuing to do that until they can find something that will ultimately get them a win at home.
A lot of calls, even from Adam Hogue here, to say, you know, you're at 0-3. You obviously are selling a rebuild with all these young players. You're almost forced into it because of all the injuries. I mean, it's amazing when you go down the list of all the players that make money that are on the bench right now. Is this a time when we do a rebuild within a rebuild and just play the young players, play all the rookies, play the Jordan Howards now he's going to have to play. He's the man. But, I mean, just go after, you know, getting as many young people reps as possible, young players, so that, you know, this could help us in 2-3 years from now.
You know what? I think that's absolutely the truth. And here's the other thing. I mean, it's like, okay, you're playing some games that you think you're probably not going to win. And, you know, so you want to try to go out there and do something creative, run some trick plays, run misdirection, run the halfback option pass, or, you know, double reverses or whatever, because you have to give yourself a chance to win. You can't just line up, you know, across the line of scrimmage from the team you're playing and saying, okay, we're just going to play this vanilla defense or offense, and we're going to win the game. And I don't see that right now. I don't see the creativity. You know, I don't see the time spent trying to find a, you know, a weakness in the other team or run some sort of a play, because you know what? They need some help right now. They need a big play, and the other thing, special teams hasn't helped them either, which is one third of the game.
I say all of your draft picks that you have available, and you go get Le'Veon Bell, who comes off of the suspension in Pittsburgh, because D'Angelo Williams is doing well behind him. Get him out of Pittsburgh now. He can be on the new Bears star, and we go to playoffs. Boom, I just solved it, Doug. Just solved it. No one listens to me.
Just think about it, though. You know, the longer that you keep going without a win, you know, so now, what, there's, you know, three games that are done, so you've got 13 games. If you need 10 games to win the season, you know, to get in the playoffs, now you're looking at finishing out 10-3. Probably not going to happen.
Yeah.
So you have to start putting things into logical decisions. And I agree with what you're saying, Justin. I think they should evaluate every single person on this team that's a younger player that could produce, could come in and make a difference on the football team. Maybe not this year, but certainly next year. And you hate to always say that, you know, geez, it's, you know, it's over, because it's never really over. I mean, it's not over until you make up your mind it's over. And, you know, like I said, you keep going back to hopeless situations like that Buffalo Bills game last week. And, you know, that wasn't just a win. That was just a domination.
Show some fire, right. That's what we're looking for.
Fire.
Show some emotion,
it was fire by the staff as well as the players. And that's where the Bears need to be.
Doug Plank, the former Bear great, number 46, former coach, analyst for NFL, joins us here on The Download. One of these days, Doug, we're going to talk after the Bears win. I know it. I just have a feeling. We haven't done it yet, but I have a feeling it'll happen sometime. Maybe this year, maybe next. Doug, great to talk to you.
Well, yeah, and I just feel bad for, you know, OB and Dan Hampton and Glenn, you know, after the game. I mean, that's when it's really, really fresh and raw. And, you know, I hope we get a win for their sake, too.
Right. All right, take care, Doug. Thanks for joining us, bud.
Okay, Justin, thank you.
More to come here on The Download. Coming up, Todd Mayfield's going to join us. He's the author of Traveling Soul, The Life of Curtis Mayfield. In it, he does the biography that only a son can do. Todd Mayfield, the son of Curtis Mayfield, will talk about the lifetime's career living with one of the most influential musicians of all time, one of my faves, Curtis Mayfield. So we'll talk with Todd coming up here on The Download. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up a little bit later in the show, Adam Conover from True TV's Adam Ruins Everything will be with us. Talk about his big show he's got coming up at the Park West next week. It's sort of a election Adam Ruins Everything, election themed. Also, musician Rachel Yamagata is going to join us. She has Chicago roots. She played in a band called Bumpus here for a long time. And she has got a new record out, Tightrope Walker. We'll talk about her show coming up at Talia Hall as well. Well, when you think of musicians from Chicago, you think, well, Kanye West, Smashing Pumpkins, perhaps. Maybe the band Chicago. But none of those artists come close to the visionary that was Curtis Mayfield. Just move on up toward your destination. Though you may find from time to time complication. From the Impressions to an impressive solo career, Curtis Mayfield was a driving force in music, both the sound and the movement. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame musician died in 1999 after living as a quadriplegic after a freak stage accident. He was survived by members of the Impressions, producers, and, of course, his family. His son, Todd Mayfield, has written his father's story in the new book, Traveling Soul, The Life of Curtis Mayfield. In the book, he talks about his dad's early days on the South Side, to his family's move to Cabrini Green, to the early days of doo-wop, to providing the soundtrack to the civil rights movement. And it is my pleasure to welcome Todd Mayfield to The Download. Thanks for being here, Todd.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
I feel like I've lived a lot of your life by reading this book today. I am immersed in your story. Let's start. I mean, you mentioned in the book, you say there have been biographies about Curtis Mayfield. There have been a couple to this point, but none of them were able to really hit it on the mark because they didn't really include his private life.
Exactly. I mean, you know, that's really what I think people are going to find the most interesting. In addition to, you know, all the music that he's produced and written and performed. I think people really didn't know who he was as an individual, partly because he was pretty private about his private life, and we as his family kind of, you know, kept in that line. And so I think people will find it really interesting.
What did you have to do? I mean, you obviously have stories and you were, you know, you lived life with your dad and for good and bad. But what did you have to do to write this biography? I mean, you talk about you talked to a lot of different people he worked with, including other family members as well.
Yes, there was a ton of research that we had to do. My collaborator, Travis Atria, did a wonderful job at just being very detail-oriented in his research and just uncovering all sorts of things that I didn't know and different interviews and what have you. So it really came together when we collaborated and then adding the research and then the personal interviews that we did with family members, business associates, other artists that he performed with and that he worked that worked for him. So it all came together pretty well, and we're happy with the results.
I mean, for you as you know, as the son, I mean, when you there's a lot of stories in this book you didn't know about, right?
Yeah,
talk about that. I mean, talk about the experience of reliving your life. I mean, your relationship with your dad through interviews and putting together a book.
Right. Well, yeah, you know, some of the more surprising things early on came with the family research. You know, I knew we came from Louisiana, and my great-grandmother, who had a church called Traveling Soul Spiritualist Church, she was a heavy influence on him. I didn't know that our name could have possibly been Cooper instead of Mayfield when she changed their names.
Changed your name,
after,
right?
Yeah, after she moved to Chicago and began a relationship with a man with last name Mayfield. So things like that. You know, I kind of start off the book. I won't tell everything, but Jerry
Butler. You got the whole hour, Todd.
Yeah, Jerry Butler gave us a few stories from early on and about how cool my dad was in the face of, you know, wise guys and other, you know, promoters who may want to rip him off. And,
right.
You know, but he always was steadfast in getting his money. So those were pretty cool stories.
Well, I mean, one of the great things about the book and the story of your dad was the fact that, I mean, his career was the quintessential, you know, sort of music to make it kind of career, where not everything that he did, it's not like they handed him a guitar when he was 5 years old and he's like, oh, he's the most successful guitarist of all time. I mean, he worked it through. I mean, there was this grind that goes through records that he put out that didn't work well, or, you know, combinations of band members that didn't work out. And, you know, so many things throughout his illustrious career that didn't necessarily go his way, but he was a grinder. He pushed through. I mean, he kept on pushing, if you will.
Yeah, he did. I mean, he's totally self-taught in more ways than one, not only musically, but business-wise, and he just had a vision. And again, I think a lot of that goes back to my great-grandmother Annabelle, who was, you know, like I said, a spiritualist and had her own church, and then she had the kids, you know, form a choir, and so they, you know, they kind of traveled around and did friendly competitions with other spiritualist churches from around the country. So all of that, I think, was very influential on him.
Why don't we start there with Annie Bell? I mean, that sort of was the a character in the book that really at an early age for Curtis really sort of, you know, got him interested in music and gospel music and all things, but also got him into music. But he's even said in interviews that, you know, this was the person who was the influence on his life. This was the father figure, if you will, the person that he looked up to the most.
Right. Yeah. So she came up from a tiny town called Mansfield, Louisiana, part of the Great Northern Migration. And she brought with her, when she came up to Chicago, the spiritualism, and where she believed, and she others believed that she could speak to people who were dead, and that right. she could actually communicate with them, and then, you know, and then communicate what their thoughts and wishes were to their relatives and things like that. So she actually ended up having quite a decent following, and that made her relatively prosperous for that time. And I think my dad saw that. I mean, because his family was very poor. I mean, sometimes they couldn't even have, you know, anything to eat for dinner. They'd have right. water for dinner. Right. But through her church, my great-grandmother Annabelle, she was able to live a relatively prosperous life and, you know, and had all the basics covered, food, shelter, and relative comfort for that time.
And they lived in the South Side, and we talked about the different places that Curtis Mayfield has lived in his life. But there was an attraction to gospel music that really was the roots, the start, obviously through his grandmother, your great-grandmother. But really, that was the foundation of Curtis Mayfield's music.
Absolutely. It was definitely rooted in the church and in gospel. And then, you know, a lot of times to make a song secular, you would just substitute something else for God.
Right.
You know, it could be a woman or a person or whatever you were talking about. You just kind of make a substitution instead of having God in there, and it's a secular song.
We're talking with Todd Mayfield. He's the author of Traveling Soul, The Life of Curtis Mayfield, his father. He's got a book launch party coming up at Promontory on 5311 South Lake Park. It's going to be on October 1st at 3 o'clock. We'll talk more. Let's take a quick break.
Great.
And when we come back, let's talk about the early days of doo-wop and the forming of the Impressions. I mean, that story is one that Chicago knows a lot about because they really do hold dear the Impressions and a lot of the doo-wop bands that came out of here. We'll talk about how that got started and catapulting the fame with Curtis Mayfield. Todd Mayfield, my guest, his son. Stay with us.
Keep on. Keep on pushing. I've got to keep on pushing. I can't stop now. Move up a little higher. Some way or somehow.
It's hard to cut that song off, Todd, I'm telling you. All of the stuff from The Impressions. The Life of Curtis Mayfield, the book Traveling Soul. We're talking to Todd Mayfield, Curtis Mayfield's son. He's written the definitive biography. The book launch party will be on October 1st at Promontory in Hyde Park. It's at 3 o'clock. Todd, you know, we left talking about doo-wop in the beginning of Curtis Mayfield's career in doo-wop, and it really started when he moved to Cabrini-Green and started rehearsing at Seward Park and
right.
some of the places. And this was the beginning days, if not the beginning, of the housing project.
Yeah, it was the beginning. I believe that they were the first family to move in the row house where they lived on Hudson, right off of Chicago Avenue, and which is an honorary Curtis Mayfield Street now. I don't know how long that's going to last since that area is turning over so much. And
no,
those houses will probably be gone soon. But.
Hey, the houses may be gone, but that street stays
yeah.
Curtis Mayfield Street.
I hope so.
I'll help you.
I hope
okay,
so.
we'll yeah. protect that.
So back then, I mean, that's just what a lot of young people did. I mean, they practiced, you know, and they sang on the corner instead of doing other things like they do on the corners these days. But it was all friendly. It was all a bunch of camaraderie. They had you know, competition to see who could get the most people to stand outside of their practice hall to, you know, to kind of peer in and see who's actually, you know, making that music and creating that sound. So that was, you know, it wasn't only in Cabrini-Green, but it was all over Chicago and all over the country. I would think in a lot of urban areas where a lot of kids got together and they, you know, formed singing groups and what have you.
The Impressions obviously came shortly thereafter. The Roosters was the original name, and then changed the Impressions. But talk about that, because it's Jerry Butler, it's Curtis Mayfield, the others in the group.
I mean,
this was the start of something, a friendship and a chemistry that lasted for decades.
Right.
Talk about your dad getting together with these gentlemen and the beginnings of the doo-wop sort of explosion out of Chicago.
Right. Well, Jerry and my father actually met at my great-grandmother's church. Jerry, his family was a member there, and so Jerry and my dad met there, and they sang within the church's choir. At that time,
would this been like the early 50s?
That would be, probably around 50, 52-ish, you know, maybe 53. And so even back then, my dad started trying to teach himself to play the guitar. And he also had a little small group of younger kids. And Jerry was working with some other older guys, Arthur and Richard Brooks and a guy named Sam Good, and all out of Chattanooga, Tennessee. And so they were the Roosters. And Jerry recruited my dad to join their group because he wanted to actually have someone with a tenor voice and also who could play an instrument.
Right, right. And your dad played a very specific style of guitar.
Right.
Self-taught, which is self-taught. Amazing to think about how F-sharp. Prolific he was as a guitar player throughout his career, but it was self-taught. And
right.
he added something that a lot of groups didn't have.
Right. His sound was distinctive because it was tuned to F-sharp, which is not standard tuning. F-sharp is all the black keys on the piano. So he didn't know that was wrong. So he just did it and ran with it, you know, and just had that distinctive sound.
What came next was, you know, a great sort of lesson in how, you know, R&B and doo-wop and sort of rhythm and blues took off here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. So many bands that were here were getting signed. There's VJ Records,
right.
Other record companies, Chess Records, of course.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But talk about that time, because that's really when, you know, your dad and others started to be able to get airplay, to be able to record records and get a career started.
Right. Well, they were performing at a talent show, Washburn Community Talent Show, and that's where they were, for lack of a better word, discovered by Eddie Thomas, who was a little bit older also, but he managed other groups, and he was just kind of a hustler guy that would just, you know, kind of help move things forward.
There's a great image in the book where he's got the Cadillac, and he's the guy you want to talk to.
Yeah, yeah, because right. he was really good at talking and building relationships and kind of moving the ball forward and helping organize and coming up with a vision.
And he played a huge role in your dad's career.
Yeah, absolutely.
Years later, but continue.
Absolutely. So Eddie met them at the talent show and then decided to work with them. He liked what they were doing. He hated the name, you know, Roosters. You know, people would start crowing and everything like that when they'd be on stage sometimes, you know. And so he suggested that they change their name, and so they finally came up with the Impressions.
And the Impressions, to skip just for time, obviously putting out record after record,
right.
and touring off those records, but it really, there's so many. What was the song? Precious Love?
Is for Your Precious
Your
Love.
Precious Love.
That was the first hit that they recorded.
And that really is what broke them in the way that now everyone was paying attention to. They loved it. They were able to tour off of this. And when we talk about tour, it is a grind. We're
right.
talking city to city. Not the greatest travel arrangement. This is not rock and
circuit.
Roll. Right. Talk about that. But that was a huge break. But at the same time, it wasn't like your dad was rolling in it because he had a hit record.
No. First of all, there's, you know, you're splitting it five ways with the group, and you know, you're young, so it probably wasn't that great of a contract. It was your first deal, so you probably weren't making a whole lot of money off of it either way. But it did give him a chance to tour and what he would call woodshed and practice his craft and get comfortable out there on bigger stages and bigger venues.
Right.
And ultimately, they played the Apollo, which was probably his biggest concert at that point, when, you know, he was all of, I think, 16 years old.
There's a great story right there where they decided they wanted to play something that maybe from Elvis Presley.
Right.
And the audience was like, no.
Right.
They were introduced to an audience that was not necessarily friendly for
right.
the first time in their career.
Exactly. So they had to learn how to adapt and deal with, you know, pleasing their audience instead of just, you know, playing standards, which I think they were trying to play a couple of those, you know, songs that the folks in Harlem weren't too excited about.
Todd Mayfield is my guest tonight. He's the author of Traveling Soul, The Life of Curtis Mayfield. Curtis Mayfield, of course, his father. He's going to have a book launch party on October 1st down at Promontory. It's at 3 o'clock, Promontory in Hyde Park, the great restaurant, 5311 South Lake Park. All right, so let's take a quick break. We'll take a break for the news. We come back. We'll make that. Well, you know, this isn't the. There's so much to talk about. I could talk to you for 3 hours just on the doo-wop stuff alone. But we'll talk about, you know, the decision to go solo. And what came of your dad's life, you know, when he became a huge star and it really became the soundtrack for the civil rights movement here in this country. We're talking with Todd Mayfield here on The Download. Stay with us. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio tonight, my guest at the big table, Todd Mayfield. He's the author of Traveling Soul, The Life of Curtis Mayfield, who was his father. He's going to have a book launch party down at the Promontory on Saturday the 1st, right? The Saturday the 1st?
Yeah, Saturday the 1st. Yeah. Time flies.
I know, right? the Promontory, 3 o'clock. You know, we left off talking about the doo-wop scene. The impressions, I mean, they just took off. I mean, if you think about the mid to late 60s, The Impressions had so many hits. I mean, everything from Keep On Pushing, People Get Ready, we're Winners. I mean, it's just crazy how many songs when you're going through the Impressions catalog that were just smash hits that stand the test of time. Talk about what your dad was going through as it went from struggles and playing the Chitlin' Circuit to, you know, crossing over into a place where the music was becoming larger than life.
Well, I think as time went on, he became more confident in what he was doing. Again, he was always looking at what was going on in the world around him and taking that in and processing it and putting out a message of inspiration for the masses. And so with more success, I think he began to feel like there were things that he wanted to say and express that maybe the Impressions, because of their track record and their history of being kind of like giving folks food for thought, I think that he kind of wanted to get a little bit more edgy and a little more personal about
with the music because it was a doo-wop band.
Right.
And you're seeing in the 60s and even turning into the 70s, much more of a funk kind of guitar, a lot of going on there that the Impressions weren't about.
The movement was kind of changing as well, too, at that time because obviously Martin Luther King was assassinated. And then you kind of had a little bit of the Black Power with the Black Panthers and other actors coming in. So I think he, you know, began to get a little bit more edgier and kind of focusing more on what folks were feeling in the streets and in the community.
I want to take back to the idea of the Chicago sound.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you dedicate a little part about the Chicago sound and what that was when it comes to R&B, when it comes to music in general. What was the Chicago sound that your dad sort of became the pioneer, the champion of?
Well, I think it kind of started not only with himself, but Carl Davis, who was a record producer.
Yeah.
And then also a gentleman named Johnny Pate, who was a magnificent arranger, who basically wrote a lot of the horn lines per my dad's dictations, because my dad could not read or write music, oddly enough.
That's crazy to be able to write all this music,
and you don't have a formal education in music, so you can't read and write it. So you just have to dictate what's the sounds that are coming out of your head to someone who can transcribe it. So, you know, Carl Davis, Johnny Pate, my father, they created, I think, the Chicago sound, and my dad worked for Carl Davis very often because Carl Davis had his own label. I think it was called OK Records, and so my dad would write and produce for a lot of his acts and artists, and so that's kind of how it became.
You know, the other thing we mentioned early on is your dad with the Impressions, even before that, with the gospel music, and even after that, he lived a life on the road. I mean, he was someone who seemed to be very comfortable with the way that musicians had to tour, but it also took an emotional, mental toll on him in the sense that, you know, it was night after night, and a lot of times, as we mentioned, it wasn't necessarily the best accommodations and transportation. But talk about that, because the book is called Traveling Soul. There is something about your dad and the road that are sort of synonymous.
Right. Well, the road is a necessary evil. You know, you got to get out there and promote the records. And touring is actually a huge source of income for recording artists, because oftentimes, again, you know, the recording contract itself isn't extremely lucrative. Even if you do, if you are fortunate enough to get a hit, you may not get a whole lot of money just from the recording contract. So, but what making a record would allow you to do is to go out and tour, and that, you know, that gives you the ability to make a decent living.
And the other thing too is that he did have the ability by touring to have his sort of finger on the pulse, if not on how to make a hit record, because that was something you talk about in the book, but just what was happening in this country when it came to the movements and to the civil rights movement and other things, that he was there with the crowds and the audience and he would understand what was happening. So it made it easier for him to write these anthems, write these songs that became the soundtrack for a movement.
Right. And oftentimes he would talk about how respectful the audiences were after a period of time where he was writing these more socially conscious songs. And the people would get quiet in there and really, like, listen to what they're doing, and then they'd go crazy after the song is over. But it was kind of that dynamic oftentimes with between the group and the audience.
You know, let's talk about his transition from the Impressions to a solo record. I mean, that was a difficult move for him, obviously leaving the Impressions he'd been with for decades to embark on a solo career. That was tough for him, the idea of, because Fred and was Sam.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, entire lives together. They were almost kids that came up together. They made decisions. They performed music. They toured together. There was they were really considered family.
Yeah, they were like brothers. Right. And so, but one good thing about it was that, you know, he had just started his own label, the Kurt Tom label, with himself, Kurt and Eddie Thomas Tom. So that gave them two acts to start with, right? So yeah, the Impressions, and they inserted a gentleman named Leroy Hudson to take over the lead. And my dad still did a lot of their writing and producing. But, you know, then they had two acts, and he started a solo career and with the Curtis album, which was a big hit. And
that record, I mean, that's the one that everyone will know. I mean, Curtis Mayfield, your dad has lived a lot of different lives. He lived, you know, as the Impressions and doo-wop. People remember that time. But the solo records, Curtis, and even the soundtrack to Superfly.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a style. I mean, the Hell Below, Move On Up, as we heard in the earlier in the thing. This was a different style of music.
Yeah,
a music
sound,
that a lot
totally.
Of people hadn't heard before. Talk about where that came from. What moved him to move in this direction when it comes to this music?
Well, again, I just think it was a changing times. I mean, you know, the civil rights movement was kind of petering out, and, you know, the philosophy of the nonviolence was turning to more of a black power and we're not going to turn the other cheek type of sentiment. And so the whole nation was just getting a little bit more edgy. The sounds were, you know, becoming really funky, you know, with a lot of bass and still a lot of orchestration from the strings, but it was just a lot more edgy and funkier.
Let me ask you this question. I mean, this, you know, I don't know what the answer is, but I mean, you were born in what, 66?
Yes.
So this was all going down, 71, 72, even 73 was a Superfly soundtrack.
Superfly was 72, 73,
yeah.
Right?
What are the memories of that time? I mean, not from the research, but do you have any memories of your childhood of being the son of Curtis when all this was going down?
Yeah. Well, you know, we definitely used to tour whenever we could to do short hops, like if he's performing in Milwaukee or somewhere in the Midwest, you know, we run out there with him and stuff like that. And a lot of times it's boring for kids, you know, the image may be like, wow, you're going to this concert, you're backstage, but oftentimes I'd be back in the back sleep, or, you know, we're playing chess or something like that, just kind of waiting for the show to happen. And but yeah, I definitely remember those times, and I absolutely remember when he was scoring the film Superfly, because he had a really huge contraption of a videotape recorder that had the film, and then it had like a time sink at the bottom. So he's always like, you know, trying to figure out where he wants to cue the music and stuff like that. So I was only like around 6 years old, but I still remember that vividly.
And you mentioned, you know, there's something amazing for music lovers and for people who were into your dad's music to be in the room when he's, you know, working on Superfly, the soundtrack, which became such a huge hit. But for a six-year-old kid, it's not as glamorous to watch a musician work out a song than the actual finished product.
No, it's like, you know, come on, Dad, let's go play some basketball. He's like, I can't do that right now.
Talking with Todd Mayfield. He's the son of Curtis Mayfield. He wrote the book Traveling Soul, The Life of Curtis Mayfield. Let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll wrap it up. I want to talk to you about, you know, the waning days of his life.
Sure.
I mean, the accident, which happened in 1990, was
yes.
that right? So he lived 9 years after that. We don't
right.
have to get into detail about, but, you know, the lighting rig falls on him in a bad storm in a concert. And he's essentially confined to a wheelchair and to a bed for the rest of his life.
Yes.
He'd still be able to make music, things of that nature. But we'll talk about that because you entered his life at that time, even before that, and re-entered and had a great relationship with him. So we'll talk about your relationship with your dad, Curtis Mayfield. When we return, stay with us. We've only got like 8 minutes left, which is killing me here, Todd. I got to say, the book is so great, and it's a great story of such an influential man, especially Chicago, and it's really great that Chicago plays such a role in this book from the early days of his life to even where the Kurtom Records was, 5915 North Lincoln Avenue,
right
here in Chicago. The book is called Traveling Soul, The Life of Curtis Mayfield. It's written by his son, Todd Mayfield, who's my guest tonight at the big table. It's going to be at the Promontory on Saturday for a book launch party, 3 o'clock. You know, let's talk about your life. I mean, obviously being around your father, a texter just texted in saying, you know, could you ask Todd what he knows about working with his dad when he worked on the record with Gladys Knight.
Right.
And, you know, just when I mentioned that to you, your face lit up because you in the book, you know, you talk about you being an 8-year-old kid and loving Gladys Knight. Talk about that experience, but also just the idea of being around this movement as such a young kid.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was always just what we knew. You know, people ask all the time, you know, what was it like growing up in that household and with a father like that? It's normal to us because that's all we knew, you know. But, you know, we did get a chance to spend a lot of time with him. And often when we were with him, we would be in the studio. And he's producing various people. And I definitely remember being in the control room while he's producing Gladys Knight and the Pips for the Claudine soundtrack, which was an amazing soundtrack and a really great film, too, with James Earl Jones and Diana Carroll. And, you know, one of my most vivid memories is that I just loved Gladys Knight. I just thought, you know, she was the greatest woman around, you know. And, of course, she, you know, would be nice to me and, you know, that sort of thing. So that was a lot of fun to be around that. And we were able to, as kids, my brothers and sister, able to be in the recording studio with them a lot.
How hard was it? I mean, you talk about some of the pros and the cons. You know,
yeah.
So what I do like about this book is that, you know, you talk about your relationship with your father, but you also talk about some of the demons that he had in his life.
Right.
Drug use, some other things, you know, that he had with bad relationships and things of that nature.
Yes.
What was it like for you as a son to have a father who was not only famous but on the road? Meaning, you know, for Traveling Soul's the name of the book, but
right.
he was gone for a lot of his life when he needed to make money and go out on the road, he was gone, and there were a lot of times you didn't see him.
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, even when I was born, I mean, he wasn't back home for over a week, almost 2 weeks. So it was difficult on my mother. And as I mentioned in the book, it was almost like, you know, he was an absent father, but he wasn't absent. You know, he was definitely in our lives, but sometimes it was like both ways because he would be on tour or just not, you know, be available as a lot of other families are or fathers
sure.
are when they have a regular 9-to-5, you know, they're going to be home at 5:30 and, you know, they're going to eat the meal and hang out, go to bed and do it all over again. So it wasn't exactly like that. But at the same time, like I said, that's all we knew. So it was our normal and, you know, I don't think we were any worse off for it in the end.
Well, your family wasn't divorced because your mom and your dad didn't get divorced, but they split at a certain point and hit
right.
two houses. So you would be at his house at certain points. And you
right.
talk about towards the end, especially as things kind of, you know, as a career kind of dwindles towards the end, which is hard to believe. I mean, there's some stuff in here. I'm like, I can't believe all the music he put out
right.
after the hits that we all know, just trying to strike another hit.
Yeah.
But being around that, yeah, he was, you know, and you talk about this, he was someone who was a private individual and he spent a lot of time by himself. And even when you guys would be over, he'd shut the door and go in the room and he would be all by himself, and
right.
and what kind of toll that took on you as a family. I mean, there was a point where you were resentful about sort of that idea.
Yeah, well, you know, all that most kids ever want from their parents is to spend time with them, you know, just to do little mundane things or just to do nothing, just hang out, just like I do with my 8-year-old. I just know she just wants me to be around, you know, and that's, you know, that's one thing that you miss sometimes, but you just deal with it. It's because, you know, there are so many other things that he did that were really good. And so you have to take the good with the bad sometimes. But overall, and you know, he definitely showed that he loved us. And I think that was something that overrode everything else, you know, the good and the bad. But so you know that there was love there. And he was actually very nurturing and, you know, will teach you a lot of life lessons.
You know, some of your family got in the business pretty quick with your dad. You were one who went to college, you know, did your own thing. But after college, you show back up and you reconnected with your dad, and you had an adult relationship touring with him,
right,
and being a part of the business. What did that mean to you to have that the relationship with your dad at that stage of your life?
Oh, that was very important. I mean, I always, and we talked about this when, you know, when I was a kid, that, you know, at some point, we'd work together, you know, I'd help him run his business. And it was really fulfilling when I finally got a chance to do that. It wasn't under the best circumstances, obviously, because he had a catastrophic injury. But I felt that I was able to step up and make significant contributions to the well-being of the family from a financial standpoint and just for a stability, from a stability perspective. So.
Let me ask you this as we wrap up. I mean, you know, not everybody gets a chance to write a book about their dad. You know, I'd love to write a book about it. Even reading this, I was like, oh, man, I really, that would be an emotional experience. How emotional was it for you to go back into some of these stories, to think about your life in the 60s, the 70s, even your adult life as you were, you know, with your dad after the accident? How difficult was it for you to, and emotional was it for you to write this?
It was emotional at times because you're reliving, you know, painful moments, and it was great at some points because you're reliving joyful moments. So it was a mixed bag. But and then, you know, you have other family members who are kind of anxious about what you're going to say. You know,
yeah,
are you going
right.
to tell too much, or, you know, what are you going to do? So there's a little bit of that we had to work through as well, and had to make sure that everyone was comfortable with what I was doing, and, you know, so they would support it because I couldn't have done it without my family members.
It's amazing to think about your dad and the story and to get even deeper when he was a kid and made fun of and some because of his appearance and how he kept that for his life, and then just the emotional experiences of him going on stage and being able to find self-worth in that experience. I mean, there's so many life lessons that come out of this. For you, what do you take away from this after doing this project and also as someone who lived it? What's your takeaway about your dad's life?
Well, I think overall, you know, he was just a person who found himself at a very early age, and he knew that that's what he wanted to do. Most people don't experience that, you know, they kind of flail around and, you know, figure it out later, but he found himself at a very early age, and so it's basically like, if, you know, this is what you love, then that's what you do. You work towards it and then go for your dreams and your aspirations. I mean, I think the only job he ever had was when he was maybe 14 years old. He sold Dunhill cigars,
right?
You know, door to door downtown here in the Loop. And so, you know, and another amazing thing is that I wouldn't obviously not recommend the kids, but, you know, he dropped out of school in ninth grade. So this was it. It was like, it's going to happen, or it's just going to be, I don't know what's going to be. But, you know, he made it happen in a big way.
Todd Mayfield, the author of Traveling Soul, The Life of Curtis Mayfield, obviously Todd Mayfield, Curtis Mayfield's son. You know, for your daughter, your 8-year-old daughter, I mean, are you telling the story of her grandfather?
Oh, yeah. She knows who Grandpa Curtis
she
is.
Does.
She can hear a record on the radio, and she knows that's him.
No way.
Yeah.
And because, I mean, we don't even have time to talk about how hip-hop, I mean, you could make a strong argument, and I could spend 30 minutes talking about how Curtis and the music of his time, and specifically him, inspired and developed hip-hop as we know it. I mean, you think of all the tracks that he did throughout the 70s are tracks that everyone is using now.
Right.
It's pretty intense. It's intense if you really look at it.
Yeah, the list of hip-hop artists and just other, you know, pop artists and everyone who's covered his music or sampled his music is quite impressive. So,
Todd Mayfield, my guest, he's going to have a book launch party at the Promontory down on 5311 South Lake Park Avenue. He will be there on Saturday at 3 o'clock. Todd Mayfield, my pleasure to have you here on The Download. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Justin.
Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is a sketch and stand-up comedian who hosts the true TV show Adam Ruins Everything. Adam Conover uses his show to call out untruths, marketing and deceptive practices, and everyday goods and services. This can be anything from hydration to reality TV to football to, well, who wears what and why on the red carpet. Adam is based in Los Angeles, but he's bringing his stage show Adam Ruins Everything live to the Park West on October 3rd, and he joins us tonight. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me. Very happy to be here.
So let's talk about this, because this show is really a manifestation and a continuation of what you did with College Humor. Talk about where the concept comes for Adam Ruins Everything.
Well, you know, I'm a stand-up comic, right? But I've also been sort of an information sponge my whole life. I'm just sort of like the kind of person, you know, in my car, I don't listen to music. I listen to podcasts and audiobooks. Stuff like that. So, like, you know, don't go on a road trip with me. I'm a bad road trip companion. I started putting information like that in my stand-up, and I noticed that when people did, the very first story I told was sort of our most popular piece about diamond engagement rings,
right.
And about how the diamond engagement ring was a marketing creation by the De Beers Diamond Cartel. They came up with it in, like, the 30s. They were like, we want to sell more diamonds. Let's come up with this idea of the engagement ring. Let's put it in movies and magazines. Make a big ad campaign, and then 100 years later, everyone's forgotten the ad campaign, but now we're all doing it, right? They straight up implanted this cultural tradition that profits them into our culture, and that's why we do it today, right? So I started telling that story on stage, and I noticed that when I did, people didn't just laugh. They sort of, like, perked up. They were like, oh, whoa, holy crap, is that true? You know, et cetera. And it got an extra reaction from people. So then at College Humor, we did it as a video there, as a web video, and it was a huge hit. And we're like, hey, let's pitch this as a TV show. And True TV was the network that was cool enough to buy it. So that's, you know, and we've been doing it there about 2 years, and it's been growing bigger every year. It's really wonderful to do.
Well, the character, I mean, how much of it is you personally and how much of it is a character, a comedy character that you've come up with?
It's a little bit of both. You know what I'd say? I'd say it's about as close as, you know, if you imagine, like, you know, Larry David on Curb Your Enthusiasm versus in real life, you know, it's like a heightened version of myself, right? So, you know, I really do know, you know, the facts that we do on the show. They're real topics that I know and I want to talk about. And in real life, I really do bother people with, you know, surprising information and sort of, you know, will tell you the truth about something right as you're eating it, you know? Then on the you know, on the show, I play this very self-deprecating version of myself who has no friends and who is always pushing people away and is sort of like this, you know, this nerd who doesn't know how to relate to people. And that's very much based in how I used to feel earlier in my life, you know, when I was like 15, 16 years old, et cetera, or when I was in college. Now I'm a little bit more socially adjusted, but it's still based on my real personality traits, you know? So it's sort of like a comedic heightening of my real self.
Well, like I said, I mean, it exposes untruths or deceptive practices. And I'm curious with the show. I mean, you come from, like you said, a stand-up background. You've comedy, you know, comedy in your blood. Do you actually start with the jokes, or do you start with the untruths when you're putting together a package, like, say, the one on football?
Oh, we always start with the facts first, you know? I mean, a lot of the time we'll have an idea for how it's going to be funny, you know? So we were, you know, basically the way our pitching works is, you know, all our writers pitch a lot of topics. So we had the idea about, oh, nobody really understands what the real problem is with brain injuries in football. Oh, we have this idea about hydration, that people are way too worried about hydration based on, you know, you don't really need to be that crazy about hydrating yourself. You drink when you're thirsty, you're fine. You don't need to drink eight glasses of water a day or anything like that. You know, it's an overblown fear, right? So we had those ideas, and then we're like, well, the season's starting out, you know, in football season. Our new episode's premiere. Oh, what if we do a football episode? And, hey, wouldn't it be funny for Adam to be that annoying guy at your Super Bowl party who, like, doesn't really watch football and is instead just making, like, weird, snide comments about the game? I think we've all sort of been there, right? And so we combined all those ideas together and said, okay, that's what the episode's going to be. But then, you know, from then on, we really start the writing process with the information first. So every act of our show is sort of structured like this, you know, essay argument where we're walking you through the topic, and then we layer jokes on top of that.
And a lot of the jokes are, you know, are visual jokes, obviously, for the television show, but you work with a lot of sketch comedians and stand-ups who help you and set up different places. How important is it to have the community of friends and collaborators who you can count on to be able to make those visual jokes around the truth that you're telling? selling?
Oh, my God, that's a great question. It's incredibly important. You know, I'm drawing on, you know, I've been doing comedy in New York and then in L.A. for, you know, close to 15 years. And you know, you make friendships with people who, you know, you have, oh, that person's a great physical comedian, that person's a great joke writer, et cetera. And then, you know, no one can make a show like this all by themselves. So when you're putting it together, you really lean on the skills of other people, you know. So we have sort of a rotating cast of sketch actors who come in and play different characters. There's this one guy, Adam Lustick, who's this bald guy. If you've watched the show, you might recognize him, who plays like a lot of our old presidents and people like that, you know, and these big theatrical characters. We have another guy who does a lot of impressions named Avery Monson. You know, the show really comes out of, you know, I got my start in comedy doing sketch and stand-up at once, and so it really comes from being both things at once, where we'll do a verbal joke and then we'll pan over and we'll see a funny little sketch scene that's, you know, three jokes long, you know, right off of that. Like, you know, we'll make a joke about Nixon and then we'll see Nixon do the silly thing that we're describing.
Right, right. Adam Conover is my guest. He's the guy behind Adam Ruins Everything on True TV. He's bringing Adam Ruins Everything live to the Park West on October 3rd, right here in Lincoln Park in Chicago. You know, the concept of exposing this material is something that is a grand tradition on television. If you think about Mythbusters or maybe even Penn and Teller, who have had the great show for a long time. Are you a fan of those kinds of shows, or are you a comedian that, you know, stumbled into this kind of thing?
Well, I would say I'm both things at once. You know, I am a fan. I am a big fan of both of those shows. I loved Penn and Teller's show during its first run. I thought that show was great. But, you know, in the same way that they're magicians doing a show about, you know, those topics, about skeptical topics, I'm a comedian doing a show about my topics, you know. So I never claim to be, you know, anything other than a comedian. You know, I'm not a college professor. I'm not a researcher myself. I have incredible writers and researchers working with us who, you know, fact check all of our scripts and make sure we're not wrong about these things. But in general, I'm just a curious person and, you know, read articles. And then I know how to convey the information to the audience in a really punchy, entertaining, funny way, right? And I like to think about the world deeply and learn new things. But at the end of the day, that's all the project is the show is a project of sort of curiosity and questioning, you know? And we never claim to have all the answers. And in fact, I'm pretty sure that one of these days we're going to find out that we were wrong about one of the statements we make on the show.
That was my questions. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you run the risk of, you know, of being in a position where you know, something changes and the truth has shifted? What are you going to do when that happens?
Well, you know, one thing that we do is we're very transparent about how we make our show. Right. So we list all of our sources on screen and then we publish a bibliography to every episode online so people can go and check our work. In the event that someone says, you know, I've had people quibble with me. Oh, hey, you were wrong about this. And I say, oh, why do you think we're wrong? And they say, oh, well, the source you cited gives this number is this, you know, but then this other source says that, you know, the number of people who do X is, you know, this other number, right? And the nice thing about that is now we're having a conversation. They're not just saying, hey, idiot, you're wrong. We're having a conversation about the topic, right? About the sources, about the process of inquiry. And usually that conversation turns out pretty well, you know. But the main thing for me is that the show is, again, it's about curiosity. It's about undermining what you think you know. It's about questioning what you think you know. And we want people to watch our show with the exact same questioning attitude that they take towards our topic. Well, I want them to take what we say as gospel.
Yeah, I mean, you're in a great spot where, I mean, there seems to be a fervor for this kind of thing, too, especially as we sort of have to live with so many untruths on the Internet swirling around our social media feeds. I'm interested because, you know, you'll take on everything from reality TV and the Kardashians to the National Football League to De Beers, like you just mentioned. I mean, do you guys get any pushback from some of those powers that be that are like, oh, man, don't tell us how that's we dispute that. We don't want you talking about that.
Right. I mean, we've gotten a little bit of that in the past. Nothing really big. I expect we might, you know, we go after some pretty big targets this year. And so I expect that we'll get a little bit more pushback from some corporate folks. But first of all, you know, the network, True TV, totally has our back. They get what we do, you know, and they don't want us to pull any punches. And so we never get any, you know, problems from advertisers or anything like that. They're really great about it. But then secondly, because all of our stuff is so well sourced, because it's going back to sources and fact checking, that helps us out a lot. Because in most cases, and this is really what we look for, topics that if you know the field, you know that this is the case already. You know, like De Beers can't come out and say, hey, we don't really have a diamond cartel that made up the engagement ring, because it's a matter of historical fact that they did. You know, mm-hmm. Journalists have written books about it. People have written articles about it. And so if they want to take up an issue with that fact, they would have taken it up with the journalist Edward J. Epstein, who broke the story, right. You know, close to 30 years ago. Right. They're not going to come pound it on my door just because I popularized his work. So same thing with football. You know, our whole claim with football is that, you know, it's not just concussion. It's subconcussive hits that cause CTE, which is the brain disease that causes, you know, early onset dementia and et cetera. And so basically, you know, anyone who plays football, even if they avoid concussions, are exposing themselves to this, you know, to this disease. That's, you know, we're just repeating the work of the best researchers in the field, you know. So, you know, I hope we're pretty well covered in that department. You know, again, I'm sure we'll have a run-in with somebody sometime, but, you know, that's our philosophy.
I mean, the grand tradition right now is you see a lot of cable programs, not just what you do, but I think of The Daily Show and others, that the Colbert Report was very similar to this in the way that they use comedy to be able to talk about the truth or to dispel notions that are out there. I mean, this is sort of becoming a grand tradition where a whole generation of people are not getting their news or their investigations from newsrooms like the Chicago Tribune here in Chicago. Instead, they're getting it from shows like yours.
Right. Well, you know, first of all, it's an honor to be, you know, mentioned in the same breath as those shows, right? I mean, Jon Stewart was like my Johnny Carson figure. Like, I grew up watching him, and he was the one who taught me, and I think taught the country, that comedy could really have something relevant to say about the culture at large and could move the needle of the culture, you know, and that comedy could take on serious, important topics and have serious, important things to say, you know. And so, yeah, now, what, 20 years after you started doing that, there's a huge flowering of all those different shows, you know, all the children of The Daily Show, right? And if so, if people want to say we're in that same vein, I'll happily accept that just because I love all those shows so much. I would never want to say, look, what Sam B and John Oliver and all of them are doing now is incredible. I would never want to say, oh, we're as good as them. But if you want to say we're in the same, you know, we're doing the same work, fine by me. But I think the main thing is that the distinction I draw is that, you know, between what we do in journalism is that all I do is I take the facts that incredible researchers, journalists, scholars, academics, right, they have found and developed. I signal boost them to a broader audience, right? I take that research and I make it funny. I make it poppy. I make it work in 7 minutes. I put some funny faces and I make some jokes. Right. But without those people doing that original work at the Chicago Tribune, right, or the University of Chicago or wherever else, I wouldn't even know that truth existed. Right. Because that's not what I'm trained to do.
Right.
I'm not trained to, you know, I'm not trained to find out the truth about concussions or whatever. All I can do is repeat what I've learned. So I think of us as the last step in the informational food chain. You know, we're the ones who take that article that you maybe didn't read, but you would have been interested in. You know, you had a long day at work. You don't have time to go home and read the New York Times today or the New Yorker or whatever. We take that article, we digest it, we make it funny, we give you that same impact and that same feeling you might get from it in, you know, 20 minutes. So that's sort of our goal in the world. But, you know, insofar as we can make the world a better place, you know, that's one of the missions of the show, and make the world a more informed place, and we do our best to do that every day.
Stand-up comedian Adam Conover, he is the man behind the True TV show Adam Ruins Everything, and he's going to be bringing his live show Adam Ruins Everything live to the Park West on October 3rd. Adam, thanks so much for taking some time out to talk to us tonight. We appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. I really hope people come out to see the show. It's going to be, we're doing a whole hour on the on this upcoming election and the history of America's election system. It's going to be, people are going to laugh and learn, and their minds are going to be blown 20 times. It's going to be great.
Great. Sounds great. Coming up, Rachel Yamagata is here. We'll talk to her about her new album. Also, her time in Chicago. It's not really noted. She's a great singer-songwriter, had such success really as a solo performer. But she got her start in Chicago bands in the 90s, particularly Bumpus, the band Bumpus, which I've always loved. I feel like, you know, there's always a connection there. But I remember seeing Bumpus in the late 90s all the time around when we were doing Schadenfreude. I remember Bumpus was in the building, if you will. A lot of the same bands in the same sort of area. So we'll talk to Rachel about that time and about her new record, which is much anticipated, which is out right now. All right. So I guess it can't be much anticipated if it's out right now. That's it. Yeah. Well, that's a boner. That should be a new segment. Come up with a new segment. Also tonight, the Defiant Thomas brothers are here. I'm very excited. We had them at the big table. They will be our guests, and they will play the worst with us tonight. 312-981-7200. We got some great stuff to give away. Some prizes, of course. This is a segment where we complain about the worst things in our society for prizes. So it's coming up at 10 o'clock with the Defiant Thomas brothers, Paul Thomas and Seth Thomas. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest tonight is performing at Thalia Hall on October 4th. The show will serve as sort of a Chicago homecoming for indie singer-songwriter Rachel Yamagata.
Gone, she's gone. How do you feel about it? That's what I thought. You're real torn up about it. And I wish you the best. Without it, and I will be, because you've worn me down. Oh, I will be, because you've worn me down. Worn me down like a road. I did everything you told. Worn me down to my knees. I did everything to you. But you can't stop thinking about her. No, you can't stop thinking about her.
Yamagata spent several years here playing music in Chicago. She sang with the great band Bumpus, but that was a long time ago, and Rachel has embarked on a tremendous solo career. Her album Happenstance and her single Worn Down put her as on the indie rock map, if you will. And now she's just released her latest album called Tightrope Walker, which is her first full-length album in over 4 years. Rachel Yamagata joins us now on the Download. Rachel, thanks for taking some time out. We appreciate it.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So is it exciting to come back to Chicago? I mean, from your time that you were in here in Chicago playing music with Bumpus, is it always fun when you go on tour to come back here?
It is, because I really feel like Chicago was what gave me my musical start. I didn't pursue music. I didn't know I was going to do music as a career. It really started in that city and with the band Bumpus, and they taught me everything I know. Like, literally, their chemistry was infectious, and the first time I saw them at the Q Club, I was hypnotized and and completely drawn. I was like, I need to be up there playing tambourine, doing anything, and without that start, I just don't know if I would have ever found music.
Really?
So, yeah, I love coming back to Chicago. Yeah, and actually, another Chicago local, Michael McDermott, was a friend of mine, and I ran into him at the Green Mill, and he was the one who handed me a business card and said, call this guy, and this guy happened to be a scout at a record label, and that's really what started me on a path of a solo career. So there are a lot of big starting points for me in Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about that time and thinking about being in a band, being in Bumpus, but also getting your start in music, what do you take with you? What stays with you, 15 years later as you're in your solo career?
I learned so much, and I really feel like we went through the steps that really helped to give me the muscle to do this. You know, we used to rehearse weekly, play weekly. We'd record at 4 a.m. when we could get affordable studio time. You know, we were all working jobs at restaurants like Tsunami and Kamahachi, these sushi restaurants, these amazing places. And the staff would come to our shows. And we really paid our dues in terms of, like, hitting the ground and hanging posters and, you know, recording what we could. And, you know, it was in those early days that I learned about all different aspects of really trying to get the word out about your music. And they had this great work ethic of perfecting songs and constantly writing and recording, and all of those things really help me now, because I started with that energy to go after it and to give it my all. And it definitely wasn't one of those overnight success stories for me. And it makes you appreciate it a lot more when every time something happens, it brings me back to just being very grateful for this entire process.
Well, I remember seeing Bumpus in the late 90s, different places all over Chicago, Subterranean or something like that. But, you know, what I loved about the band is that it really was a diverse collection of instruments and instrumentation. For you, your solo career has namely been behind the piano. But this album, the new album, which is coming out, Tightrope Walker, you expand a little bit. You bring in more instrumentation, you bring in more sounds. Talk about the evolution of changing the sound of Rachel Yamagata.
Especially with this record, I really had fun in a new role as a producer, and I took it on much more so than I ever have in the past. And my sound engineer and I really made a studio in my house and tracked, you know, everywhere from the living room to the kitchen to the amps in the closets or bathrooms or whatnot. And there was something about being free in my own space and having not being on the clock of a studio or having that kind of parameter to be held in. And it really led to a lot of working on Instinct. You know, we gathered a bunch of friends from Woodstock, New York, where I'm based, and had these fantastic musicians who happened to live up there, and people that I worked with and known for a while. And then I brought in John Alasia halfway through. And so the experimentation part of the entire record really led to things like me saying, oh, you have a saxophone. I didn't know you played. We have to put that on the record. Or like this, there's a particular song, Tightrope Walker. In fact, I was like, it needs something angular and edgy and almost uncomfortable in there. And I'm like, I need a particular sound. So I would just bang on things. And then it turns out if you pile a metal ironing board and some 12-foot ladders and various chairs out in the middle of the woods and mic them just right, then you can like get this crazy sound. And we had Ben Perowski, this amazing drummer who plays with Rufus Wainwright, a million people, you know, in the middle of the woods tracking these drums. And I had these French friends who I'd taken on tour, and I had them translate a letter that I had written into French and sing it in this monotone voice underneath a track called Rain Song. So I really just kind of went to town with the creative, you know, pot of different ideas, you know, and I think that's what led to a lot of the new sounds on the record, just having fun.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, the process of experimentation and discovery, I mean, you'll hear a lot of artists who will talk about the process of making that art is what they enjoy. The coming up with the material and, you know, being able to express themselves creatively in the moment is what they enjoyed, as opposed to, you know, necessarily what happens after the finished product is done. Do you feel the same way as a producer, as a music producer now, having been able to be creative, to be able to do the things you just talked about?
I do love that, actually. I mean, each component of things has its, you know, pros and cons. Like, we're on the road right now, and there's nothing like live music. A live show is so spontaneous. You never know what's going to happen. It's a collection of people you may or may not have played with before. It's like summer camp. It's very grueling, but there's amazing things that I love about interpreting the songs for a live audience. And then the energy that you receive from the crowd is like it's a big thing for us. It like keeps us going, and it's a very interactive process. Record making is another form of summer camp with, you know, these musicians who, when you catch the right moment, everybody can feel the energy. And I'm fascinated by that. But there is something to be said for the process. And then, you know, I won't listen to the record after it's done unless I hear it randomly.
Really?
I'll just happen to, I'll forget that it's in something and I'll hear it. Or, yeah, because you spend so much time with it, you have to kind of let it go. And you know, I'll listen back and want to change things, or I'll listen back and be like, oh, I didn't even remember we did that, or that was cool. So, yeah, it's interesting all across the board.
Yeah, Rachel Yamagata is my guest tonight. She is playing at Thalia Hall on October 4th. Her new album is out, Tightrope Walker. All right, yeah, I'm interested in that concept, too, because, you know, You've had several albums. You've had success, and a lot of the albums have been places where you've been able to write songs about heartbreak, about love, and then you take those songs with you and you continue to tour them and perform them on stage. So talk about your relationship to your songs. As you sort of evolve as a human being, how does your music evolve?
You know, they change. They definitely change through the years in terms of, you know, people ask me, do you get depressed or how can you go through that every night and sing that lyric that's so heavy? And they change over time. And what I've found that's interesting is, like, you can always bring new meaning to a lyric that you wrote 10 years ago. And I found this out when we did this acoustic version of Happenstance. We just released this, basically the same record, but reinterpreted to just voice and acoustic guitars and any little trinket I could play in the room, but really, really found a way to sing the lyrics with a totally different meaning for me underneath each song. And you can hear it, if you A-B it, you can really hear some of the differences. There's a track called Quiet that I sang an ode to. Those are two of the ones where it really stood out for me on Happenstance, and there's such a naive, kind of innocent, heartbroken approach to me singing it. It sounds very young and almost like a little girl, and you hear it now and it was like this irony or this layer of other meaning that those lyrics took on simply just because of what time does to a person, how you grow. And so I think you continue to find new things about your own material as the year goes on, and I think that's why it's always interesting to see what an audience takes away from something, because it could be entirely different than what you intended or what somebody else takes away from it. And that's part of the great thing about music. And certainly with the experimentation on sounds, I think I probably befuddle a lot of people who want to put me in a particular genre. And I've always kind of relished that about myself, because I enjoy so many different types of music, and I like seeing where it goes, and I always try and do production to serve the storyline. And another way that Bumpus was really influential was because they were such a diverse group, and they still are. They're still an active band. But we had, when I was in it, there were three different lead singers. There were elements of hip hop and soul and funk and. But the influences were, you know, they introduced me to Nina Simone and Tom Waits and Prince and P-Funk. And it was always like a map, figuring out a map to do the right set list, to incorporate all of these genres and, like, see how it worked. And that taught me a lot about how to do it in my own set. And made me appreciate the different aspects and styles of music that's out there.
Yeah, and I would say, I mean, you've made a career collaborating. I mean, you've had such great collaborations. I mean, just to name a few, Rhett Miller, Ryan Adams, Mandy Moore. And in different ways, either whether you're singing on tracks or you're writing or you're just collaborating musically, that seems to also come from the concept of playing in a big band like Bumpus, and also even with this record, Tightrope Walker, there seems to be an emphasis on collaborating to be able to find that experimentation with the drummers and the other people in the room. How important is that in your writing and your music to be collaborative, to be open? And does that come from somewhere?
I think for the writing process for me, it's hard. It's actually hard for me to co-write a lot. Like sometimes in my collaborations are, I'll hit on something more successfully. If it's for somebody else, I'm a good partner to write with. When it comes to my own stuff, it's very tricky for me to find that right partner that still really embodies what I'm feeling or what I want to be saying. There's a guy, Mike Viola, who's a good friend of mine, and we have a great writing relationship. We've done some of my favorite songs together, like Deal Breaker, You Won't Let Me. There's a bunch of things that we've done because for some reason it just works. We'll go into a room and come out, you know, 2 days later with 11 songs, and it's strangely effortless. We just have a lot of fun, but it doesn't always go that way. So writing is a little bit different for me in terms of the collaboration. In terms of actually producing the music or making records, that's where I really love to collaborate fully. And every record I make, I'm equally certain that you know, everyone in the room plays a part in producing it with the ideas that they bring to the table. And I work very carefully to try and get the right people in the room. And it's not always, you know, sometimes it has everything to do with vibe or energy or just somebody has a knack for something or, you know, they contribute in a way that you wouldn't even expect. And I think I'm very good at surrounding myself with great folk. And I certainly feel like that we're in a collaborative state when we're doing anything musically, definitely.
The new album is called Tightrope Walker. Rachel Yamagata, who spent time here in Chicago with the band Bumpus, tremendous career as well as a tremendous record, Tightrope Walker. Thanks so much for taking some time out. You're going to be at Talia Hall on October 4th here in Chicago, and we look forward to seeing you. Rachel, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you so much.
All right, coming up, we're going to play the worst, 312-981-7200. This is where we complain about the worst things in our society for prizes. I actually got a pair of tickets tonight to Rocktoberfest, City Winery, coming up. That's cool. So that'll be something to give away. It's pretty simple. You complain about the worst things. You know what's the worst, Pete? Boneless chicken wings. I'm sorry, it just doesn't work.
Really?
I'm not a fan of it, no.
See, I hate bones of any sort.
I mean, I hate bones too, but boneless chicken wings, it's just, it's sacrilege. It doesn't work. It's like, you bite in, it's just not right.
Hmm.
Stick with a chicken finger.
Is it? Yeah, okay. Isn't, you know, a boneless, I mean, chicken wing just a chicken strip?
It's even weirder.
Hmm.
It's weirder. So that's the worst. That's coming up. The phone's already lighting up here. 312-981-7200. I'm excited tonight. Seth and Paul Thomas, the Defiant Thomas Brothers, got a new show at Second City that's starting this weekend, Saturday. Good friends of the show, good friends of mine. They are going to be in studio with us tonight to ride a shotgun and play the worst. So that's great. I was just talking to them in the green room, and it's so fun because I'm so jealous. We've done comedy together for a long time, and the fact that they've been able to get back together and they're going through the rehearsal process as we speak. I mean, I ran into them in Second City this weekend where I'm like, what are you doing? They're like, rehearsing. I'm like, what are you, 20? Who rehearses? And then I realized, I'm like, oh man, I love that process. There's nothing I love more than like the actual process of putting together a comedy show, a stage show. With your buddies, you're putting it all together. There's something great about the late nights and working through problems and figuring out the puzzle of putting a show together. And that's what they're doing right now. So I'll ask them about it. We'll talk about it. But I am very jealous. That's always a fun thing to do. It's good. It's good stuff. A lot of people say, oh, I love to get on the stage with the lights and the people and the audiences. I don't know, man. I really like the process, the creative process that leads up to it. Anyway. That's coming up. Defiant Thomas Brothers will be here. We'll play the worst coming up after the 10 o'clock news. It's the worst here on 720 WGN, our segment we do every Tuesday night from 10 to 11, where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. And we've got plenty of prizes tonight. 312-981-7200. We'll be doing this all hour. 312-981-7200. You can text, you can call. Let's have some fun, right? Good guys to have in studio if you want to have some fun. The Defiant Thomas Brothers. Yay!
Hey!
Hey!
Seth and Paul Thomas, they got a new show, the great sketch comedy group from Chicago that has been performing. I know there was a time you took off, but there's, I would say, what, 12, 15 years now or something like that?
Yeah, I guess our tombstone's 2002 to 2006.
Yeah.
2015 till Jesus.
There you go.
Yeah.
They got a new show, which is at Stage 773, that starts this Saturday, October 1st.
Where is it, Justin?
It's Stage 773. Good to see you guys. How are you, man?
It's good. We're good. Yeah. We're good.
All right. So let's, first off, I mean, you guys have been doing shows at Second City just recently. And before that, you had a show. How is it to actually work on new material and put a show together that isn't sort of going back to the greatest hits?
Stressful.
Yeah.
And fun. Yeah. It's fun. You know, before, like you said, before it's like, oh, let's retool this and then comb through it. And then with the new new show, it's kind of, we were talking about it like it's kind of like that sophomore album for her artist, yeah. Right? You know, like that first one.
Right.
I've been singing these songs for 15 years. You know, I was at Ray Ray's Barbecue Chicken House doing these songs, right? And now you've only got like a year to put out like a whole good album. And you're just like, right.
You
does this work?
Do you go conceptual? Do you go live album? What do you got to do? You got to figure something out.
Yeah.
Well, that's the difference between stand-up. You work stuff out and find what's written. You know, you know as well as anybody. It's not like, hey, you know, let's go to sketch night at the whatever to work these out 55
night,
times.
Right.
You're like, yeah, so you're.
No, you got to do them like the first time people see it will be Saturday, right?
Yeah.
Right, I love it, though, man. I'm excited.
Yeah. The worst part is knowing going in that it's obviously not all going to, you know what I mean? No matter what, you're going to find
but
stuff.
But that's the fun of it. The fun I know, is but the that's energy the, yeah. of like the Band-Aid.
Oh, yeah.
Like when you know it's you miss something or it's not working and you guys use, you know, your great comedic talents to make it work. That's the fun part. Which pretty much means one of you guys is going to strip to your skivvies, you know, because the bit's
there's
not working.
Skin. We got
There's some skin in this show. There is some skin in this show.
There is skin.
You know, it was just like, what should we wear for the scene? Nothing.
Yeah. That's a surefire. Yeah. It's surefire.
Yeah.
It's, you know, listen, look at you guys.
We had to get in shape for this one.
Yeah.
Actually, this
is,
we did.
Burpees. The worst.
Vanity is a powerful.
Burpees are the worst.
Vanity is a powerful motivator.
Yeah. All right. Paul and Seth Thomas, the Defiant Thomas Brothers, are going to be at Stage 773 October 1st. All right. Let's play the worst. Let's start off tonight with Pete Zimmerman. Of course, Pete is the kicks us off every night. All right, Pete, what do you got prepared for this week?
You know what's the worst?
What's the worst, Pete?
Well, this is going to be layered. What's the worst? When you get a phone call, first, that's the worst. It's calling anymore.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And you get a call from a person, and they leave a message. And you listen to the message, and then the number is different from the number that's on your phone.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
And then you have to, like, find, like,
call me at 773.
Yeah.
Well, the number says 312.
Right, right.
Yes. You're trying to find a pen.
It's
like,
modern technology.
Hey, remember this remember this number for me. 312-575.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, the worst.
That's as bad as people calling you from a landline. I did this the other day where I text somebody like five times. I'm like, are you coming on the show? And I'm like, they're not answering this. I don't understand. And then I called them. They're like, you know, Johnson Solutions. I'm like, oh, this is your work line?
Yeah, yeah.
What is this?
Right.
This is, come on, guys. Everything should be textable.
I leave my number. I call from a cell. I still do that out of habit, though.
Yeah,
I leave my number like it's not right there, but then I repeat it at the end slowly. I'm just trained.
Okay, but it's 2016. The worst is voicemails at all. Like, why do it?
Why do it? Yeah.
I see your number.
Right.
I don't listen to it for three days.
I see
it.
I know who
I can't.
I know who it is.
I have to commit to set aside
time. Right, right. I only check my voicemail to get rid of the light. Like, you know, like just to get rid of the little audio tape.
Right.
Whose idea was that to use audio tape symbol
for
voicemail?
Well, I mean, there's so much there. I think that's a good starting point for people to call in. 312-981-7200. Let's get some people on the line. Let's do some texts. You can win. Okay, we got some prizes to give away. The fifth annual A Leg to Stand On Rocktoberfest at City Winery. It's coming up. So that's cool. Wow. You have to go to Rocktoberfest. I've always wanted to go to Rocktoberfest.
Is Rocktoberfest like the Springfield where like every state, there's like 17 states one with the Rocktoberfest?
Every state has a Rocktoberfest.
Yeah. I think this is like, it's just called Rocktoberfest. I don't know.
I wonder what the first one was. It's got to be a special thing.
Yeah, right. But it's cool that this is the fifth annual, it says. So
where is it?
At City Winery.
Ooh, I like that place.
Also, we got a Lou Malnati's gift certificate and a pair of tickets to an evening of music with Broadway composer Stephen Schwartz. So we get a lot of variety tonight. All right, Paul, why don't we start with you? What's the worst? What do you got for the worst?
Well, I think I'm going to start a race war here because...
Good start.
Is backgammon. Because you might get some call-ins here. I just like, that's the game in your house. You're like, who plays that? Who plays that? So that's like I do. So I'm doing an informal black survey in the building. It's like, oh, did you play backgammon?
No.
Do you know the rule? Right. It's just like the extra board that you turn your checkerboard over to set stuff. You could leave rings on that. Your mom doesn't get mad when you set your cup on there.
You've talked to two different black people.
I have a survey.
Yes, I play backgammon.
I've got
and of course
66%.
Both of them represented all blacks in America. Let's
exactly.
Make that very
so
clear.
My
and
three.
This is not sarcasm. This is real.
This is real, but I want to know this. I want to know, is this actually a thing? Because he's so like, we had this whole decked out thing. So I'm like,
in your family, they play back in.
Oh, yeah. There were like at least two different sets. There was the small travel set. There was the large set. There was the velvet set that only played if your grandfather came over.
See, if you tell me about that, I don't want to go to your parlor. I just assume if you play backgammon, you have a room called a parlor.
Yeah, possibly.
So I'd really want to know the racial
breakdown of
the breakdown
games?
Of no a backgammon a specifically backgammon.
Specifically backgammon.
Specifically, so this is like Cuban dominoes. You know, you're like, oh my gosh,
yeah.
Like you grew up like right, again.
Right. Well, the worst is getting a spanking because you use the dice to go outside and gamble with your friends. And so now mom can't play backgammon because you done took her dice.
That's very relatable. That's a relatable worst.
Yes,
all right, well, let me throw it out to the listeners. 312-981-7200. We're playing the worst, but we'll also, you know, we'll answer Paul's question.
Is fan the flames.
Backgammon
he got a backgammon set.
Is it a predominantly black game? I don't know about that. I feel like I had a backgammon set growing up.
You did. We had them, but nobody played it. And you didn't do it. You set stuff in there. You put your Star Wars action figures in the nice one to carry around. Otherwise, it's on the backside. You flip it. It has a little design. You trace it for designs for school because it looks like stained glass.
Well, the callers are calling in, so that's... So
there we go.
Here we go. 815 says, I am white. I do not know anyone else who is white who plays that game. All right, I think they're just playing you here at 312-981-7200. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll play the worst. Stay with us.
It's going down,
playing the worst here, 312-981-7200. Paul and Seth Thomas in studio, the Defiant Thomas Brothers, no relation. They are their sketch group. Great sketch group here in Chicago, and they got a show that's coming up here at Stage 773. Starting on Saturday, good to have these guys in studio. And the burning question is about backgammon, so why don't we get to it? Ron, you have an issue with backgammon. Do you play it?
Yeah, but, you know, you don't have to be black, white, green, or whatever. I mean, I've been playing it since the 70s.
How old are you, Ron? How old are you?
69.
See? We just talked about it. I think it's... Right now, in my head, it's two-thirds of black people based on my sampling of three black people tonight, and then people over age 65.
Yeah.
So I think you're fitting in there. So that's, you know.
You're right, though. You don't have to be a color to play. You just have to have a sweet board. Let me ask something. How many die do you have?
Well, let's see. Three, four? I don't know.
There you go. Do you have the velvet cups?
Who's calling
you have
you,
the
Ron?
Sweet? Yeah, who's calling you? Answer that.
No. I have a...
Landline?
Leather one, and I have a cardboard one. It depends on which game, you know, which travel game or
right,
solid
see?
Game.
Wow.
So well, it depends on if you want to do it on an airline.
You can do it all. All right. All right. Thanks, Ron. Yeah, so. Thanks for giving us an insight to who plays backgammon. 630 says, let's see. Are you all familiar with the common backgammon travel set? Of tacky vinyl and plastic, likely with lead poisoning.
Yep.
While we white folk had leather case and ivory game pieces lined with baby claw fur. Come to think of it, no, we never played it. Displayed it though, probably played on the travel edition.
I just got a text from my buddy Jim that just said, "I'm pretty sure I gave you mine because I didn't play it."
Exactly. See. All right, let's get back to the game. 312-981-7200. Seth, you got any worse you want to say?
Yeah, the worst is people who just stop in walking down the sidewalk and they just stop, you know, because they can't text and walk at the same time. So you just stop. And I just want to kick them in the back, but then I feel like I'd be the wrong one, right? You know? But it's like, you just stopped. I want to walk up your back. But
I do that, though. Yeah. I passively go as close as I can and then really make it like I barely dodged him. Because they have to know.
Yeah, I had a situation.
If you can't text and walk, walk.
I had a Michigan Avenue situation where there was a guy who was walking. Guys were walking slowly. And so I got right behind him, and you're trying to get around him, and they're kind of, you know, taking up the whole sidewalk. And this other guy comes up, and it's almost like Shake and Bake from, Ricky Bobby. Like, he just, like, slingshot. He gets right up on my back, and then he cuts me off to cut in front, and then he turns left. And I was super annoyed. He turned left to go onto the side street. I thought for a second, I'm like, should I? I was going to shout. I was going to stop and shout and be like, have some etiquette. We're all trying to get somewhere. And I didn't. I said it in my head. It was like a Life of Walter Mitty moment where I was like,
because how do they, even if you're the one and they get mad, at least it will remain in their head that they did something wrong. That's why I feel it has to be said.
It's like a falling down moment. You know, you got to tell these. You got to tell.
You got to let them know.
On the divvy bikes, is going to Lakeshore last couple weeks, when couples go next to each other in the bike lane, and they're just going, you're like, you can't do that. You got to go single file. It's your romantic little divvy bike outing. You got to go single file. That's how that works.
Divvy bikes are the worst.
Come on now.
Yeah.
I'm a divvy bike fan now.
Yeah. The idea of riding in the street and the only thing protecting me is a painted white line. It's not safe. That's the worst. The worst is the painted white line. Give me a small 2-foot concrete rail that I feel safe behind. Right. I'm good. But half of Chicago can't even make left turns.
That's why you go to the lake where there's no cars. That's the only place I go.
You got to get to the lake.
That's why you go to the closest one to the lake and you walk your bike. Look both ways.
That's the worst. People who don't know how to make left turns. They start turning immediately when they come out of it. No, you're supposed to go straight a little bit and then start turning.
I love the free association here. All right, so 708, let's get right to it. 708 says, you know what's the worst? Serving size on food labels. The serving size would sustain a toddler, and the last thing you want to do is a math problem to figure out how much sugar is in my Arizona fruit punch.
I have to concur. And say that those are the worst are the Euro serving size. Like, get to America. We don't like plate on our plate. You know what I mean? Our servings are huge. You know, give you a box of cereal that goes like 4.
630 says, worse than Pete's, my number spells something specific. So my father, a certified genius, has been misspelling my number for 20 years. So, of course, every now and again, I get a message from a stranger woman at that number telling me, you don't know me, but your father called again. That's really great.
I want to know what the number spells.
Yeah, right? 815 says, the worst is when you wake up to yourself having a sneezing fit and you end up biting your tongue in the process.
Ouch.
Yikes.
That's a
night.
That hurts.
630 says, the worst is when people throw trash or cigarette butts out their car window. That's so 70s. It's so 80s.
That is so, you know, I saw a guy one time like throw a whole like Big Mac meal bag out. I was like, dude, that's way too much litter. You should just,
really?
You know?
I mean, I think we're still okay at the etiquette point. If someone takes a lit cigarette and throws it out, you're like, but yeah, a full Big Mac meal out the window.
No.
Paul, where do you fall in on the litter? I have a
problem with cigarette butts. With people, here's the thing. It's a consistency thing. When we go climate change, people go, do you think small things like it, whatever? And it's that person. And then they smoke and then they throw a small cigarette butt. Like, somebody has to clean that. It's the same principle of these things building up. Yeah. We think this is insignificant.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're saying it's got to be.
I say if you don't believe in climate change, then flick your butts.
Yeah.
But if you're getting mad at other people and then flicking your butt in the street, you are
the problem.
630 says the worst is talking to your dentist.
Yes. Or no, your dentist talking to me. I can't answer.
Yeah, they go, you're leaned back in the chair. As soon as your dentist touches his nose with a gloved finger and then says open, he wants to talk. So how's your day?
Right. 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 It's been a while since I've seen you.
So how's the family? That's so good. So good. So good. 773, the worst is when I wear a velvet smoking jacket to party. And people touch the jacket saying how nice it is to feel how nice it is. And then they proceed to literally rub themselves all over my jacket while I'm wearing it to feel what it's like.
Velvet is like gravity to hands. Like, you can't see velvet and not touch it.
Oh, that's so good.
And then you have to rub it
the wrong way.
You got to do Johnny Gillett. You know? Because you have to know. You're like this, but you're like, what happened? Oh, it makes this sense. It's a different reflection. Then you try to draw your name in it, but then you can't because you have to go the other way.
I love it.
Right.
All right. 312-981-7200. I have some more backgammon stuff. We'll get that after the news.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It's on.
This is a ticker.
Paul Thomas, Seth Thomas, Defiant Thomas Brothers. Their new show starts Saturday, October 1st at Stage 773. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and play the words. Stay with us.
Don't call me when I text you. I don't want to talk to you, text back. Don't call me when I text you. I don't want to talk to you, text back. Don't call me when I text you. I don't want to talk to you, text back. Don't call me when I text you. I don't want to talk to you, text back.
There you go. Don't call me the Defiant Thomas Brothers in the studio. This is not just a sketch show. You guys are breaking out tracks.
Oh, we got tracks.
We got tracks.
That's great. So that song will be featured in the new show that's at Stage 773. Defiant Thomas Brothers, Paul Thomas, Seth Thomas in studio playing the works tonight. Good to see you guys. The show is Saturday night, Stage 773, up on Belmont. What time?
10:30 p.m.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Look at you, old timers.
A little riskier. Yeah, I know, right?
Late nights. Doing a late night thing.
I like it. All right. All right, let's get back to the worst here. 312-981-7200. The worst, 630 says, the worst is having a germaphobe in the family. Nothing is ever clean enough, and you go through a ton of bleach wipes.
Yeah, I think you just make that an ex-family member.
Yeah, you just don't visit often.
You just bleach them out of the family.
Yeah, exactly. Wipe yourself away from here.
815 references a earlier text. The worst is people who wear a velvet smoking jacket in public.
In public?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm trying to think where I've seen that. Does this happen in nature much?
Yeah, does that happen a lot?
Is this...
Are smoking jackets still a thing?
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to a party on a Saturday and you're like, hey, everybody, take a look at me. I got the smoking jacket. It's like a party game.
Yeah. I just always think life, you know, life...
Where's the backgammon?
Right.
I'm learning this.
Ball walks in with the backgammon.
Yeah. Like a briefcase.
All right, 847. The worst is being stuck in bumper-to-bumper traffic when you really have to go to the bathroom. Yeah, that's
pretty
kinda,
standard. That's standard fare.
262's got a great one. The worst, being on vacation when the work does fantasy football, missing said league, listening daily to fantasy football talk at work.
And this is in 1995, before we had the technology that allowed us to.
You know, fantasy football is the worst, though.
I think it's the worst, and I think Pete will agree. Because I'm in fantasy baseball, like my championship, and it plays out. And I, for the last 6 weeks, it's been so dumb and so intense over nothing. I'm like, the Seattle Mariners second baseman, I don't know what happened. He's over 4. I don't know what happened. And, I mean, Pete has been the most gracious friend. There's even texts that'll come on a Sunday like, ooh, Matt Carpenter, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I've sucked him in. I feel so bad for him and his family and the fact that he's interested in my dumb baseball. But I do think that fantasy talk with people who are not in fantasy land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've been out it for a while. We got big.
Well, it just messes up. It messes up your whole perspective of sports because everything's like individual and numbers. It's like, oh, I don't know about it. Yeah, but that guy.
Right.
That guy's awesome.
Great for coaching kids sports, too.
Fantastic
for coaching kids sports.
It really is kind of messed up because your allegiances get messed with.
Yeah.
Because, like, I will still not play guys that are playing the Bears, right?
Right, yeah. Right.
And you're like, why didn't I?
Yeah.
Terrible.
But that is the reverse properties of football.
Right.
You're like, well, I'm paying for them to win because they'll do great.
Maybe I should pick all the guys this week that are on the Detroit Lions.
That's the boo yes, you know, where you go – you know, it's Dez Bryant goes for 80 yards. He's on your team against the Bears. You're like, boo! Yes!
Yes!
Boo! Yes!
705 says the worst homers. Like, in the sport? Or you mean like homers, like dorks?
Or just in general.
Even the word. Who says that?
Right.
Do people really say homers?
I say homers.
It was a great homer.
I say homers all the time. I think everybody in the political business is a homer. Like, what the worst are debates. What are they there for? You've already made your decision last February.
I throw in the ref.
You're just a homer.
Ref. Oh, the ref's really. I'm like, if you say the ref and you use the word ref, I really think you never played sports. Oh, the refs. Come on, refs.
Come on, refs. Like, what are you doing?
You think that's
refs.
Lingo that you're like, we say the officials.
Come on, ref. It is lingo.
All right, let's keep going. 202. The worst is when you're at a family gathering and your mother keeps bringing up your previous perfect girlfriend in front of your current girlfriend.
Oh. Winner.
I think that's when you have an ex-mother.
That's when you have an ex. Bleach wipe her
you bleach
out
her
of the
out.
House.
You bleach her out of the family.
Send her home with her velvet jacket and her backgammon board. And
she's definitely got a backgammon
board. She's got a backgammon board. That mother
she knows
does.
How to play it. We have them. It's about knowing how to play. That's when you cross
that's
the line.
That's right. She knows
can
how
have
to play.
It.
Actually, she wins. She has a strategy.
Oh, wow. Strategy. You know what you should do? Oh, my gosh.
Could you imagine? All right.
Is there a fool's move in backgammon like you have in chess?
That's
the first thing
like
you learn.
Strategy, yeah.
Other than learning the rules, that's a fool's move of backgammon.
How do you shut your mother up though? Like, what do you say?
Yeah, what do you say?
What do you do? Like, you just.
I think you just go, whatever, mother.
Yeah.
Mother.
Or then you pull your girlfriend aside and just go, she's crazy. You just throw your mom under the bus, right?
Or you say she wasn't.
Or you just go, was dad your first choice?
262 says the worst is spend all day cooking an anniversary spam, but you end up eating it alone.
That's not real.
That's not real.
That's not real.
Anniversary spam?
That's also an age thing because the person used spam and they know what spam is, the original one.
Right.
So that person,
yeah.
That's not somebody under 30.
Right.
Look it up. Let's find that one. Mystery.
There's one 262 is like the worst is the company I worked for and then they named the company and that's it.
I agree. Yeah, that company.
Yeah. Right. Right. I don't know.
All right.
It's Pan Am.
Here's a bad one. It's right. 847. The worst is when you hit the brakes to avoid hitting a squirrel, but get rear-ended by the car behind you, and then come to find out that you still hit the squirrel, and now it's roadkill under your car.
Oh man. That's rough.
That is rough.
That's rough. Hit this. Just kill the squirrel.
Unless the squirrel was texting, then it deserves
it.
Yeah. Let's go to Tom. Tom, what do you got? What do you like, Tom? What's the worst?
Oh, the worst is when you take a boner pill and then you get into an argument with your girlfriend.
That lasts 4 hours.
Hours of hell.
Tom, do you just because of the circumstances, do you quickly try to rectify the situation?
Yes, you do. Get out your erector set and just have some fun.
No, not by yourself.
That's amazing.
That was not what I meant. Amazing. Try to make up with your girlfriend. That's what I meant.
Yeah, you just take matters into your own hands.
You rectify the situation.
No, you just say sorry. Sorry.
I set it up. I set Tom up on
Yeah,
that.
You did.
You gave
him
that was a good T-ball.
That was a terrible word choice. But, hey, you know, sometimes it's radio volleyball.
Hey,
yeah, it is.
All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll get we'll wrap up the worst. 312-981-7200. We got some more to come in, and also we will give away some prizes to the winners. Sound good?
It's going down.
Defiant Thomas Brothers in studio. We're playing the worst. 312-981-7200. You can check out the Defiant Thomas Brothers at Stage 773 on Saturday. Just sketch show. How great is it to just get back on the saddle? I mean, you guys were just doing a show at Second City, but to go through the process of starting a new show, it's got to be tight. It's got to be fun.
It's fun. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, we're not sleeping this week.
Yeah, we haven't slept. You know, four techs. You know, that's the great, tech can only be at 10 to midnight, right? After everyone's already done.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, yeah.
It's not like when we were in our 20s and you're like, now you have to wait for families and all this.
Right.
And there's a lot of rationalizing. You're like, yeah, we got that. You're like, yeah, we can do that one tomorrow. It's like, it's just like homework. You're like, yeah, we got it. And you're like, why, we have the full time, you know, but we're like, we're not that young.
You're like, let's just look at Facebook on our phones.
Yeah. It's great.
Tweet
though.
About it. That's work.
Right.
We're working.
We're working.
Pictures,
Instagram that.
All right, 646. The worst is at the gym when you get an eyeful of droopy male side boob.
Oh, you said get. I thought you said see before.
Yeah.
So get. That's
get an eyeful of droopy male side boob. How do you ever unsee that?
You don't.
But see, that's the unseeing. I thought you were talking about actually getting it when you're playing. Is this person playing or watching it in the locker room?
I think they're either in the locker room.
They're in the locker room. Nothing. They look to the side. Yeah.
Right. That's nothing. It's you get it playing when you're playing with the guy, and the guy's just a grizzly bear, and it's just sweaty, and that all over your, you know.
The worst
shirts
is the
skins.
The worst is the guy with the moobs who's got his shirt off, and they're perky. You know, that's the worst. It's like, dude, get some droop.
Get some droop.
Droop
is preferred.
Like, droop is preferred.
Yeah, it is hard to understand the perk.
Yeah, I don't get that one at all. Like, yeah.
312 says the worst is a bad mic. And then Prince says, make sniffling sound here, please, Justin. It's a debate joke from last night.
Oh.
I was supposed to follow the...
I'm sorry. We were rehearsing.
Yeah.
We missed it.
How was it? Was it fun?
Well, I mean, there was 80... They anticipated 100
yeah,
million.
Yeah, what was it?
But it ended up being like 84.
Did they beat the MASH finale? Or no? It's two other things. It's when JR, the season after JR, and the MASH finale, what else is there?
Luke and Laura's wedding. Yeah. That still might be all-time greatest viewing.
My favorite part was tonight, Donald Trump had a press conference on the tarmac, wherever he was, and he's like, look at all these people. You know, it's like, just bragged for about 10 minutes. And the big thing is like, last night was really exciting for me. It was a great night. He's like, I mean, hey, I don't know. Like 85 million people. It's the biggest event of all time. No one's ever watched a debate like that ever. I mean, that's a pretty good success. Like that was his, he was just super into the ratings. Like he
right.
just
got right. like, right. Like, yeah,
he is. Yeah.
I mean, the you know,
he's a celebritant, you know. Yeah. Like you just, I mean,
I just was amazed that he was like, yeah, "Hey, yeah. everybody wanted to watch me. What do you want?"
Well, yeah,
he's not wrong. He's not wrong.
He's not wrong.
He's not wrong.
You know, you know.
All right. So let's. All right. So it's 312-981-7200. I'm going through the text to make sure we've got them all. There's a lot of backgammon in here, but they all, almost every single text. Just ruins your theory.
Really?
Yeah, it's all people saying I'm white and I play backgammon all the time.
Great. See, there?
I think that's there. White guilt going in here. And also, did they set their ages in? Did they send their ages in as well?
No. Just accept defeat. Accept defeat. No, it is an Olympic sport.
I'm going to call it's on Smith. Its way. How much does it cost to do a Smith research thing?
What's there coming? I don't know. Like, it can't be more than $15.
Right. It can't be that much.
Yeah. This is not over.
Yeah.
I'm going to have black or white backgammon.com. Just something.
Just something that, well.
Just to find
the,
out.
It looks like 815-773 and 630 have all made the worst is our presidential candidates. So just that theme has continued over and over. And
yeah.
Tonight.
Yeah.
It's kind of boring.
It is. Yeah. Well, the worst is that both of them will be the oldest ever elected, and I don't think any of them will make it 3 years.
They just don't.
Yeah, I mean, either no matter strange, who wins, they die in 3 years. They're dead.
We're going back to the Harrison days of.
I was just gonna say, what's
William Henry Harrison?
We got 76 days. Got pneumonia with like a 3-hour speech.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's a wrap.
630 says the worst is as a Cubs fan making fun of crying Cards fans and finding out they're crying is not because of the team losing. Oh, well, I don't know. I don't know what that means. Like maybe their friend is crying. Like I think I lost my dog.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, your Cardinals. Too bad they lost. Oh, I'm so sorry.
I thought you were going with dead grandma on that one.
It could be dead grandma. I wouldn't.
Yeah, possible.
Right.
You softened up on dog.
All right. So let's get through this. All right. I've got three choices, three prizes. Third place is going to get you Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Lou Malnati's is home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumalnatis.com. Number two is going to get you a pair of tickets to an unforgettable evening of music with the Broadway composer, Stephen Schwartz. Mm. He shares live performances and behind-the-scenes stories from Tony Award-winning musicals like Pippin, Godspell, and Wicked. It's going to be at the Mack Center at the College of DuPage. Friday, October 7th, call 630-942-4000 for tickets.
I want that.
And first is going to get you a pair of tickets to the 5th annual Leg to Stand On Rocktoberfest.
Rock.
At City Winery on Thursday, October 6th, join leaders from the financial services industry for a night of rock and roll and acoustic music to benefit also on their mission of providing free prosthetic limbs and corrective surgery to kids suffering from limb disabilities in the developing world. Get tickets at altso.org/Rocktoberfest Chicago. All right, that's going to get you number one. Or Rocktoberfest is always going to get you number one.
Those are some sweet prizes.
All right, tell me, you guys tell the audience about the story as I rack these up. Go ahead. Or about the show coming up on Saturday.
All right, the show is at Stage 773 on Belmont. It's Saturdays, 10:30. It's the Defiant Thomas Brothers.
Sketch comedy.
We are some a music sketch in there. Comedy duo. Mm-hmm. Scenes, mm-hmm. songs, mm-hmm. routines. It's about being funny. One of us is black. One of us is white. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Is that important?
It's really important. It's really important.
Based on his backgammon conversation.
Just to protect me in case.
Just
I got to make it till Saturday.
Yeah.
After that, I'm a backgammon.
It should be fantastic. You know,
there's posters
all over the city. There's some
The CTA.
There's some posters on the CTA. I think.
Right, you got it. Yeah. Keep going.
You can go to Stage 773's website if you want to get tickets. If you bring a backgammon board, you can get $2 off.
Yeah. That's where you go to third world countries. There's a bunch of backgammon boards in their garbage. They're just burning them all. They're playing checkers and chess. You know, they're just using them for tables. Even the people who learned how to play are like, just give me something I can use.
Yeah, no,
it's a stupid thing.
It runs for 8 weeks.
Old white people back in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Keep going.
The Defiant Thomas Brothers. We run for 8 weeks. Stage 773. Defiant Thomas Brothers.
FindThomasBrothers.com. Google.
Google. Yeah. We're on Instagram, Find Thomas Brothers. Twitter, Def Thomas Brothers.
Yeah. MySpace.
We
were on MySpace.
We were on MySpace when we started. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's still a thing.
Is it still exists?
It still exists.
Is our profile.
It probably does still exist. Do you remember our password?
All right.
No, but Tom does.
Yeah. Would it kill you guys if you knew that I was ready all along? I was just enjoying.
Not at all. It was just
associated improv.
Yeah, that's.
All right,
just keep going. DTB,
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 DTB.
All right, here we go. Third place tonight. This is going to get you a Lou Malnati's gift certificate. This goes to 630, who said Justin. Where are we at? I gotta find it. Sorry. Here we go. Worse than that, okay, so third place is that my father has been misspelling my number for 20 years. So, of course, every now and again, I get a message from a stranger woman at that number telling me, you don't know me, but your father called again.
Yes.
Realty or reality? That's what the spelled number is.
That's a winner.
That's a winner.
That's a winner.
All right. That's
where are they asking us?
Second place. Goes to, I don't know who, I don't have the number in front, but okay, the worst is talking to your dentist. You lean back in the chair, and as your dentist touches his nose with a glove finger and then says, open, starts the conversation. How was your day?
Yeah. 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 Do you play backgammon?
And number one tonight, this is it. All right, are we ready for number one? It comes from 202. The worst is when you're at a family gathering and your mother keeps bringing up your previous perfect girlfriend to your current girlfriend. Oh, that's bad. That's bad news, right?
That's really bad news. That's bad news because she was perfect.
And now you can take just your current girlfriend to Rocktoberfest at City Winery.
Yes.
And leave your mother at home. Seth Thomas, Paul Thomas, the Defiant Thomas Brothers, Saturday night at Stage 773. Thanks for being here, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Justin.
All right, that's going to do it tonight. A little programming note. Tomorrow's the Blackhawks, so we're off. Thursday night, Matt Bubala's in for me. Because Friday morning, I'm sitting in for Steve Cochran. How about that, huh?
Go Justin.
Wow.
The big chair, baby.
It has all to do with the fact that the Blackhawks are on, so they feel like they need to get their money's worth out of me.
Don't think for one second that I won't be fact-checking you that morning, my friend.
Don't.
Go to robmartier.com for the fact check on Friday morning.
Don't downplay yourself either. It's not about the dollars. They don't even think money when they see you. They think we want this talented man on the air.
Well, we won't have a show Friday night, so I'll see you guys back on Monday, but I will be on with Cochran or for Cochran on Friday. Mark Carmson tonight for Patty Vasquez. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Justin. I'm not exactly sure where Patty is, but glad to be here, of course. Right. And
what are you going
to
do tonight?
Well, I want to talk about how we got here, as far as it's just interesting to me. I think we, as an American society, have created this, and we're not owning it. So I'm going to start there. That's
I like that.
Yeah, and so we'll have some experts on.
You got to talk some sports, right?
Yeah, maybe slip that in there on the back end. Yeah, sure, why not?
You and I have a lot to talk about. I feel like I want to talk Bulls. I feel I'm very interested in this team that's coming out. A media day practice. They say Rajon Rondo's the voice of this team.
Yeah, that's a little frightening. But okay.
Someone put on Twitter, which is great, saying, well, that's, you know, whining is a voice.
Yeah. So. And Jimmy Butler's talking about how they've already bonded. And you guys have had one practice? So let's not get crazy.
Butler's all over my YouTube videos. Every time I open any YouTube video, the commercial is a Jimmy Butler commercial.
Now, that's good branding for Jimmy Butler,
yeah, right.
I guess.
Yeah, right?
I used to like Jimmy.
Uh-oh.
I'll leave it like that.
Oh, no.
Isn't Rondo like Allen Iverson on Prozac?
Yeah. I don't see, I mean, who knows? You guys would know better than I, but if Rajon Rondo plays with that sort of intensity he had in Boston, I'll take it.
I mean, I always liked Rajon. Back in those days that speaking to, I remember him walking into the arena one night, and I was right there, so I'm walking with him. Rajon, how's it going? I mean, he looked like he was going to eat my head off. And this was like 3 hours before the game. I'm like, okay, dude, I get it. You're already in game mode. That's great.
You want some intensity when it comes to your basketball players, right?
You do, and at that time, I mean, he's playing with KG, mm-hmm. who was, mm-hmm. you know, Garnett was a lunatic in his own right. I mean, that was a good basketball team.
Well, you know, I said 12-2, 10-4 for 10-6 for the Bears.
I
still got a shot at that. I'm going to say 60-62 wins for the Bulls this year.
Yeah.
Somewhere in there. Just, well, you know.
Over-under's 38.5. I think the Las Vegas – always knowledgeable public is predicting slightly under 500 for your Chicago Bulls.
I don't buy it. Martyr.
What do they know?
Yeah, Martyr and I will take the 55 and up.
Done. Right?
Martyr cut a wide swath going through Montreal.
I did indeed. But that's a topic for a different time.
Different segment, right?